morning, the same rules apply as the rules which I have read out to all of us. We are hoping to have fruitful engagements and representations from those who will be coming to present to us for the afternoon. You are all very welcome. Any new people who have joined our platform and our meeting, you're very welcome to our meeting. And we will now continue. I have seen the MEC of Health of the Western Cape on the platform. I am not certain who is leading this delegation for the Western Cape government, who will do a presentation on the NHI bill to the Portfolio Committee on Health. And we'd like to start immediately, honorable members and those who are to present. So, honorable, who will be leading yourselves?
Afternoon, Chair. Good afternoon, honorable members. Thank you for having this opportunity. My name is Noma French Mbombo, Dr. Mbombo, MEC for Health in the Western Cape. With me, the HOD is on leave. With me is Dr. Krish Vallabhji, who's the Chief Director for Strategy and Support. And I'm sure there might be others who might have joined from the department. He's the one who's going to lead the PowerPoint presentation, but I will start with just a preamble and then we'll take it after the presentation. Noting, Chair, that our presentation is very short because we already submitted our input, I think 2019. So what we have done is to summarize so that we allow the members to engage, because this is an opportunity we wouldn't want to miss in regard to having this conversation. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, MEC. You're very welcome, and your team. We can go right on. You can start your presentation.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Whilst Dr. Vallabhji is preparing the presentation, just a preamble. In South Africa, we need to acknowledge the fact that our system, health system in South Africa, is quite fragmented with the issues of the access to the quality services. We find that it all depends mostly on who has got, who can be able to afford. Therefore, the issue of a health as a human right and a social investment, it means that it just becomes a dream in some instances because it has been now turned into a commodity. So therefore, the universal health coverage is a must for the South African community. What does it mean? It means that access to the quality services from the preventive, promotive, rehabilitative, palliative, subacute, and every aspect that is crucial. So it's long overdue for some of us who have been in health quite longer, those who are health professionals. It becomes exciting that at least we do some light in regard to the health reforms. So therefore, South Africa does need a health reform quite urgently before the systems collapse. With the NHI, Chair, in case probably some members might not be from the health space to know that this has been actually a history that has been there. The first phase of the NHI, it was 2012 to 2017, and there was an evaluation of the report in 2019. For that period, it was specifically to test the health system and using about 10 areas related to the primary health care.
Sorry, MEC, I just want to, because your people will then struggle, I just want to say to our committee secretary there's a request for screen sharing. So I'm sorry about that, but that's in order to save time. You can continue, MEC.
Thank you, Chair. I think Dr. Sadiq Karim was the one who was asking for the sharing. Is a DDG, is also Chief of Operations, who's acting HOD. Thank you for that. So I was saying, Chair, that the history of the NHI, it doesn't start now with the legislation. It starts way back with the Phase 1, HNHI Phase 1, 2012 to 2017. That was focusing on strengthening the health system, focusing on 10 areas or 10 streams. among the streams, if I could just list quickly, it was about a ward-based primary healthcare outreach teams. It was about the school health program. It was about GP contracting. It was about the ideal clinic realization and the maintenance model, the district clinic specialist team, which is I was one that I was focusing on at the time that I was advising the Ministry of Health before I became a politician, centralized chronic medicines dispensing and the distribution, the health patient registration, which is the health records, the 8th one, stock visibility system, the 9th one, infrastructure projects, and then the 10th one is about human resource for health. And from the evaluation that happened there, it was about that when now the country starts the phase two, because at the time, the decision was about 3 phases to start the phase two. Lessons learned from the phase one, it was about for successful implementation of the NHI, there should be clarity of the vision, and we should be able to set appropriate priorities. And also it's crucial that there is element of accountability. And also for the NH2, which is where we are now, supposed to have started 2019-2022, which is now the NHI, which is the bill. It also speaks about to ensure that we protect the public sector, especially in regard to their resources, and also about the implementation. So now in the NHI 2, which is about the bill, what we are coming with the Western Cape is about there's no way, there's no person in South Africa, specifically within the health system, who could be against the health reforms in South Africa. Because at the end, as a public, we absorb quite a lot of the social ills, but as yet, in terms of the budgeting, it's skewed. As I think some of the members did indicate, the issue related to the GDP that is being allocated, but noting that some of the problems that have been, because I've been here since the presentation by the private, is because of we have never had the regulation that could be able to regulate and how the private should be able to work on. And with the National Even Health Act, when it was started, it was in repealed, because the province can still use the 1977 National Health Act. So going forward, Chair, the one health system with a multiple entries in order to be able to look in terms of the needs and also the choices is just one way that the South Africa could be able to assort these fragmentations. And also the issue of the NHI in regard to ensuring that we leave no one behind. The AAAQ, which is the accessibility, availability, affordability, and the quality of care, these are very crucial. And also that notion, Chair, that talks about the affordability, because sometimes you find people where they say that because I've got, I can afford, therefore I could be able to drive a jet and all of those. But one needs to understand that the poorest, which are the ones that are actually most absorbed by the public, they also do contribute tax-wise. I'm mentioning this, Chair, because NHI3 is about the taxation, which is going to come after probably 2024-2025, if we're talking about the whole of this issue. So going forward, as a Western Cape, we do approve and also condone and also accept the universal health coverage. However, the NHI, we don't see it as a UHC, in as much as that the principles have been indicated there, because the issue of the balancing the funding, because it's just like insurance. Insurance, you can buy a beautiful insurance, but what are the guarantees in terms of getting what you want? Because you don't want to be standing outside the road where the car cannot be fixed because of the ABCD of the insurance. So what you believe in this kind, in this format, it will have a huge dire negative impact on the provinces as a whole, not only that the in terms of the purchasing, but also in terms of the whole issue of the stewardship. What we believe is about, gone are the days that now we have to create binaries and coming with these narratives that polarize, talking about the public versus the private, or the national versus the province, because at the end, we are the one health system. About 24, 26 countries already have implemented the UHC. before we had COVID, actually, we some of us, we said trip that was arranged by the national. We went to Thailand, which is similar in every respect with South Africa, as is yet the amount they pay per capita in regard to health is quite more or less the same, but the returns on investment is quite large. We are grappling with the issue of the quadruple burden of disease, and as yet we find that many people are outside the health system. Lastly, Chair, personal level, the social determinants of health that are not being mentioned in the NHI bill, it's quite a discomfort, because at the end, you cannot only focus on the service deliveries in terms of subacute, when the social determinants, which actually what is being absorbed by the health, I'm talking about the issue of the poverty, the issue of the unemployment, equity, but specifically in regards to the environmental aspect, which is the access to water, access to circulation, that is being absorbed by health. So with that, Chair, the team will present, it's going to be a short presentation, but they're focusing on the policy imperatives related to their procurement and also and other parts of it in terms of the strategic purchasing. And then we come up with a proposal, and then I'll take it from there. Thank you, Chair. I will switch off my camera.
Thank you very much, MEC. I don't see your presentation yet. And Dr. Karim, you are welcome to continue.
Chair, I think Ms. Isaac is starting the screen share. But just from my side, it's myself and Dr. Vallabji. Apologies from Dr. Kruti, who's on a well-deserved break, as you own. You just put my video on, at least I think that would be proper decorum. Dr. Kruti, who's on a well-deserved break. Dr. Vallabji is going to do the presentation on our behalf, but we've obviously had lots of discussion in the department. And as Minister said, she's very well versed with all the issues. So over to Dr. Vallabji, with your permission. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Dr. Karim. Good afternoon, Chair and honorable members and colleagues. I'm Krish Vallabji. I'm the Chief Director for Strategy from the Department of Health. We want to approach this in a very succinct way because we've submitted very detailed comments previously. So this is a high-level summary. Next slide. So we would just pass some introductory remarks. Then we want to focus on the policy concerns regarding the bill and then our proposed approach to UHC and the NHI, and then end with some concluding remarks. Next slide. So South Africa as a country and the Western Cape as a province have both strongly endorsed the UN approach and the global movement towards UHC. UHC is an approach to advance health equity by removing the barriers to access quality of care and removing financial hardship. And those are the principles that we firmly endorse. The strategic intent of the bill to achieve these principles of UHC is completely supported. However, there are specific concerns on the architecture, the distribution of roles and responsibilities, financial flows that need to be addressed. The comments that follow are intended to be constructive, to strengthen the bill, and really to promote a collaborative effort between government, national government, provinces, civil society to achieve the goals of UHC. So like I said, the province has submitted very detailed general and specific comments on the bill, and this presentation covers only a subset of very high-level comments owing to time constraints. Next slide. So as we know, in terms of a problem statement, in the private sector, the access and unsustainable cost escalations are underpinned by severe market concentration and fee-for-service incentives, and these are often perverse incentives for over-servicing, etc. And that's the nub of the challenge in the private sector. In the public sector, the access and quality challenges are underpinned by funding shortfalls, lack of good leadership and management, and governance systems in the main. And those are the kind of twin challenges of the public and private sector. What does the bill intend doing? So the bill establishes the NHI fund and its governance structures. It outlines the committees through which the NHI fund will carry out its functions. And it also provides an overview of the management offices, including the procurement of health services. It partially refers to the role of provinces and the National Department of Health, and I'll speak more to that later. Next slide. So what are the policy concerns regarding the NHI bill? And like I said, 83 pages of very detailed comments have been submitted, so this is very high level. And to cluster these concerns under the following headings: fragmentation of care, role of provinces, financial flows, strategic purchasing, the Office of Health Products Procurement, the governance of the fund, and social determinants of health. Next slide. So let's start with fragmentation of care. And the format, Chair, I'm following is really just to outline what the concerns are with the provisions in the bill and then what the proposal is. So if you start with fragmentation of care, in the bill, there's a creation of district health management offices and contracting units for primary care as national government components, right? And this will fragment the health service. The NHI and these government components, the Public Service Act actually says feasibility studies need to be undertaken before pronouncements could be made on government components. And as far as we are aware, these have not been undertaken to date. The NHI fund directly contracting with regional and large hospitals. So this would be directly from a central fund nationally, directly to the facilities themselves. The central hospitals would become a national competence as provided for in the bill. So we think that these provisions would really fragment the health service. And our proposal is that the NHI fund works with provinces to develop a single cohesive aligned system with clearly defined roles and lines of accountability for performance aligned to the principles of UHC. In the province, we have spent the last decade or two trying to build a cohesive health system. You would recall over the last decade or two, primary healthcare in the rural space has been provincialized. TB hospitals that used to be run by local government and Santa have been taken over by the province. EMS has been provincialized. Forensic pathology that used to be run by the police services have now come over. So we've been building this cohesive health system over the last decade or two, and we fear that the provisions in the bill will start to mitigate against this cohesion and start to fragment the system. Next slide. So the next aspect of fragmentation is central hospitals. So the bill makes provision for the management of central hospitals to become a national competence. Now, our estimation is that almost 44% of secondary general specialist services in the metro are provided for in the central hospitals. There is significant outreach by specialists from the central hospitals across the platform. So this will fragment both the service delivery platform and the training platform and governance arrangements in the province. We do not believe that the changing the governance arrangements of central hospitals is necessary to achieve the policy objective of the bill. So the rationale for this policy change is unclear. Furthermore, the track record of this province, the Western Cape, shows that these central hospitals are well-performing institutions. So that's further reason to not change that arrangement. So our proposal is that the central hospitals continue to function under the governance of the provincial departments of health. Next slide. So then we move on to the role of provinces. Under the NHI bill, the role of provinces is limited to emergency medical services, forensic pathology services, environmental and pollution control services, which are municipal functions, health and medical services during provincial disasters only, and maintain infrastructure. This is a significant reduction in the scope of work and the powers of the province from the Constitution, from the 1977 Health Act, which the minister referred to, and this was assigned to the provinces. So to all intents and purposes, it has the weight of provincial legislation and has not been repealed to date, the current National Health Act and the PFMA. So we see this as a significant reduction in scope and powers. So the bill refers to provinces as management agents of the NHI fund, but the delegations and responsibilities of provinces are unclear. Next slide. So the proposal is that UHC can be achieved through a strong collaborative partnership between the NHI fund, the National Department of Health, and provinces. Provinces should be accorded a clear role where they have the capacity and track record of good performance to become the NHI fund's contracting unit and responsible for the overall coordination and accountability for health system performance. Funds should flow through the provinces, who will then develop and manage contracts with a mix of public and private providers. As you see in the graphic there, so the NHI fund works through the province, who then contracts with a range of providers, public and private. The National Department of Health and the provinces should be core stewards of a trusted health system with clear lines of accountability aligned with the PFMA and the current NHA, which is both in place, and therefore this enables our movement towards the objectives of NHI and UHC, and we can achieve those objectives. Next slide. Financial flows. So the reallocation of conditional grants and redirection of equitable share to the NHI fund is a concern. Public sector health budgets have been reduced in real terms over several years, and services are in quite a fragile state. There is a separate process being undertaken currently, which is a revision of the provincial equitable share formula. And in that process, further cuts are envisaged to provinces like the Western Cape and Gauteng, right? So these are real concerns. So the proposal is that the current funding arrangements, namely the equitable share to provinces and conditional grants, should remain in place. The NHI fund should use tax subsidies from the private sector as a top-up fund in the initial stages of this process. And the public sector that services more than 80% of the population should be protected and strengthened. Next slide. Next slide, Afika. Okay, so then we go to strategic purchasing, right? The bill proposes that the NHI fund is a single strategic purchaser. Now, the dangers of vesting the total strategic purchasing power in one entity are as follows. Firstly, poor performance will have a multiplied effect across the country. Failure to conclude contracts timely will lead to national stockouts. The NHI fund may struggle to find sufficient suitably qualified and skilled staff to carry out these functions. And the large financial exchanges will make the NHI fund a target for corruption. So those are some of the high-level risks in having a single strategic purchaser for the country. Our view is that the strategic purchaser is critical to achieve universal access to quality healthcare. Negotiating prices, using economies of scale for commodities procurement, as well as the setting of tariffs to be paid to providers of services, will be an important function of the NHI fund nationally. However, determining what services are to be reimbursed by the NHI fund and the actual purchasing of services to meet people's needs and expectations must be decentralized to local settings. It is therefore recommended that provinces should also play an important strategic purchaser role in this regard. The Office of Health Products Procurement, so Section 38(2) of the bill deals with the establishment of an office for health products procurement to be located within the NHI fund. And again, healthcare is incredibly complicated, and the ability to manage health-related procurement at a national level requires significant administrative capability. The challenges to manage pharmaceutical contracts is a case in point, and it has had ripple effects across the country when this is not procured in time or tenders are not awarded, etc. And this raises concerns about the ability of the fund to manage the proposed national procurement system and the wisdom of centralizing all procurement. So we therefore propose that when this bill is enacted, sufficient and appropriate staff, systems and processes are put in place before attempting to centralize the procurement process. Then the governance of the NHI fund. So considerable authority and power is vested in the Minister of Health. Now, to appoint or dismiss all NHI board members, recommend the appointment of the NHI fund CEO and his or her dismissal, as well as to add a discretionary list of services to the NHI formulary. And we think that's considerable authority and power vested in a single person. The proposal is there should be appropriate checks and balances applied to the governance of the board, the appointment of board members, and the CEO, including parliamentary oversight. And then the last policy concern is social determinants of health. So health, the health services sector is almost the receiver of health problems caused by social and commercial determinants, such as poverty, unemployment, social deprivation, various trade issues, etc. So the bill does not mention addressing the social determinants, but focuses only on direct service delivery. Now, our proposal is that we have to, as a health system, address the burden of disease and the social determinants of health. And this should be made explicit, and health at both national and provincial levels have an important advocacy and stewardship role to play in this regard. So that, Chair, is the summary of policy concerns around the bill. And I want to move to our proposed approach to UHC and NHI. Next slide. So our approach is that health is an important economic investment with a return on investment close to sixfold, and that figure has been internationally quoted. The current dysfunctionality of the public health service and the unaffordability of the private health service is just unsustainable. So we, as the minister, as the MEC has said, we do need health reform and significant health reform at that to address these twin challenges. The fragility of the situation, including budget cuts in the public sector, are close to a tipping point. So we need to be very careful in terms of reducing public sector budgets. The stakes are high and requires us to move beyond the political divide. The situation therefore requires more than tinkering at the margins. It requires a transformative solution of doing business differently in very fundamental ways. It requires more than a financing mechanism like the NHI, which only addresses a thin slice of the health system problem. And we require a much more robust, holistic health system strengthening approach to finding a solution. And the current debate on the NHI provides an opportunity to find transformative solutions to the health system. So suggested principles for our approach, we think the pooling of resources from the private and the public sector with the shared goal of improving population health outcomes is an important one. Let's engage in a spirit of cooperative governance and collaboration and avoid the narrative of polarization, like the MEC has said, that polarization being public versus private or national versus provinces, etc., that only escalates fears. And how do we cooperatively and in a collaborative manner engage and jointly find solutions? The NHI bill will be up for review, and we use this opportunity to re-establish mechanisms for robust engagement and joint problem solving as a social compact to address all the concerns in the bill. The health system reform process worldwide is a complex ongoing process that is both technical and political. Global experience shows that we have to customize lessons from elsewhere. We cannot merely import solutions from other countries. We have to customize it. We have to carefully titrate the health system design choices we make to our local context, local conditions, and our local capacity for change. It has to be calibrated to our own strengths and weaknesses in keeping with our own state of development. In this regard, we need to be mindful of the differing capacities and track record of health system performance between provinces. So not all 9 provinces are on the same page or at the same level of development. And therefore, we need to be very cautiously titrating our solutions to these varying conditions across the country and the need for further customization even between provinces. Next slide. We need to have a holistic health systems approach that spans service redesign, governance redesign, and public policy. And it needs to be based on a culture of connectedness and collaboration, both internally to the health system, as well as externally with our partners in the private sector, the higher academic institutions, and business sector, civil society, etc., towards building UHC and achieving optimal health outcomes. The affordability and financial flows, and I've not discussed this much, but very important issue within the NHI framework, should be pronounced upon by the National Treasury. And there's been various perspectives about the unaffordability of what's on the table, but we think the National Treasury should pronounce on this. Create opportunities to learn from below. And the Western Cape is prepared to be a laboratory for testing innovative service models, which can further inform policy development in our context. We want to strengthen our collaboration with other provinces to share and learn from each other. And we believe this learning approach is the way to take this process forward. Next slide. So in conclusion, Honorable Chair, the Western Cape government would like to thank the committee for the opportunity to provide comments on the bill. The bill is an attempt to bring a solution to an ailing health system in the country. And there are elements in the bill that make a lot of sense, but then there are also concerns that need to be addressed. Learning from our responsiveness, adaptivity, and innovation during the pandemic over the last 2 years, as well as the research and development, will strengthen and build, help us build a resilient health system for the whole country. And we must take the experience of the last 2 years into account as well. So like I said previously, we are willing to become a laboratory for testing out aspects of UHC within the province. We're very committed to working with the National Department of Health to address the challenges we've identified and collaboratively find workable solutions. We believe in the country, we have the collective expertise to do this between national, between ourselves in the provinces and local government, as well as our other partners in the private sector, universities, etc. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Valapji. I'm not sure whether there is any input from Dr. Karim before we give it back to the chair and then wait for the responses, for the questions or input from the members.
Sure. No, thanks. Thanks, Minister. Dr. Valapji presented our views, Honorable Chair and members. Just one small point. During this pandemic in the province, as perhaps in other provinces, there were many, many innovations that we brought about during the pandemic that, in fact, if one looks at it over a longitudinal time period, will in fact take us towards UHC in the province. This is not a COVID conversation, but the number of those innovations, in fact, will strengthen the resilience of the health system in the province towards UHC. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Minister.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Just to add what Dr. Karim has indicated, also in terms of even working with the private, using COVID as an opportunity in regard to when we have to work around the bringing in the critical care or high care spaces, just in case we might need those. and also even in regard to the innovations in relation to those for us as a public, having like a robotics as part of the fourth industrial revolution in regard to medical care, we have to learn more from the private, not necessarily the public doesn't know, as you know, Chair, as a health professional itself, that we get professors in the public. And also it's only the public that trains medical doctors. And then once they are done with the specialization, then they go to the private. So what we're trying to highlight is that it doesn't mean that when we are saying we're learning from the others, it's about the others. They don't have the capabilities. That is the whole issue about the resources. So just to give more time, Chair, for the questions, I will leave it to that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, MHC, and to your team for your presentation here today. We have listened very carefully, and we also note that the members would like to raise some questions with you. We would have to take those questions in the following order. Honorable members, first would be Honorable Ismail, followed by Honorable Chirwa, Honorable Clark, Honorable Siwela, Honorable Gela. Any other hands, honorable members? Honorable Harvard. Any other hands before I'm going to close this opportunity? Thank you very much. We can start with raising your points with the delegation, and we start with Honorable Ismail. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and good afternoon to the panel, and thank you for your thorough presentation. I just have a few clarity-seeking questions. I'm sorry if I'm asking a question that has already been covered. I've had a connectivity problem. My first question, what are the reasons that you recommend that the governance of specialized hospitals should remain with the province? My second question, in your opinion, does the bill address social detriment of health and preventative strategies? Now, what would be the implications if these items are not addressed? And if we need to address these items, what would you recommend be specifically specified in the bill? My third question, you highlighted oversight. Now, this is very, very essential. Do you recommend the private sector be included on the board to improve the accountability and legitimacy of the board? My fourth question, under the bill's current governance and organizational structure, in your opinion, what is the state of risk corruption? How strong are the accountability measures in the bill, and what would be necessary to be included in a bill to countermeasure this? My fifth question, to what extent does the bill allow for equal access to quality healthcare? You mentioned a few lines on this, but in your opinion, is this an all-inclusive bill, and how sustainable is this bill in its current form? My last question, do you think with the current state of the bill, if it's not amended, do you feel that we will lose a lot of healthcare workers, you know, in the system? I mean, do you think we will have a lot of our healthcare workers moving abroad? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. My question to the Western Cape is, I want to know what kind of collaborative efforts do they envision between national and provincial? Because I think the roles of the province are encapsulated in the bill, but I want to hear from them how exactly they envision and how it could legitimize the bill. Like, what roles would be allocated to the province that cannot be done by national, or that would cause a crisis in the provinces? And please appraise us with in detail and not philosophically as the presentation is done. And secondly, I want to know how the Western Cape has made interventions to deal with infrastructural inadequacies, because you note that as some of the backlogs or challenges that we're facing in the NTOH example. But I mean, these are challenges that can also be found in the Western Cape as well. And I give an example of Kalisa District Hospital, because we did oversight there, and the community of services has grown by millions in the past years, but this isn't mirrored by the facility and the work that has been done to grow the facility to cater for the needs of the population that has grown by millions over the past years. I mean, the staff also raises concern at the oversight that I'm speaking about, to which it affected services like occupational therapy, which is vital for children and kids within the autism spectrum, right? And second to that, the clinic in township and rural areas don't necessarily function at a 24/7 basis. And that's not the direction that the province is taking either. What is this leadership intervention that the Western Cape assess is lacking in national that they have mastered? And why hasn't it resolved these structural issues that directly affect the communities and their health needs? Please give us tangible examples of how of the mastering of these of this leadership capacity that you guys have that the rest of the provinces don't have, and how it has changed communities, and counting even the communities that I'm counting in the fact that already you have failed to address those structural needs in those communities. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson. In your inputs, there's mention that shifting funds from the equitable share of provinces will negatively affect integrated, intersectorial connected service delivery. Can you elaborate on this point? What reasons will a shifting of funds result in a degradation of service delivery? What are the implications of the changing role of provinces on service delivery with regards to healthcare? The bill intends to dilute the role that provinces currently perform in terms of the NHI. In your view, how will this impact quality access to healthcare services? What challenges do you foresee with this shift? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. And I've got questions to the Western Cape government. My first question is the Western Cape government main concern the change in the role of the provinces? The bill states that provinces will move from purchaser and provider to become a delegated provider with stewardship of the public service. This, according to Clause 32.2, is to allow functions to follow funds in creating a single fund NHI. Please clarify what is your concern, especially the establishment of a central fund. The second question, Chair, is the presenter seems to assert that setting up the NHI fund as a strategic purchaser is risky and it is better to continue with the current fragmented system. What is the motivation behind this assertion, given that the fragmentation has not helped to address the health needs of the population? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chairperson, let me thank the MEC and the Chief Directors for the presentation. Just two questions from my side, Chair. The first one is the Western Cape government comfortable that some populations in provinces where there are no access to central hospitals care continue to not have access to the services in these national assets, as we know that the central hospitals are largely funded from the conditional grant? Then my second one, Chair, is currently the Northern Cape, which is my own province, and the Eastern Cape depend on the Western Cape Department of Health to access some of its services. Now, I'm just interested, Chair, what is going to happen one day when the Western Cape province start to deny citizens from provinces without quaternary services when they need such services? Can I please have a comment from the team? What is going to happen one day when the Western Cape denies them those services? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chair. Let me also welcome the presentation from Western Cape. Chairperson, I've got a few questions that I want to ask. The first one, the presentation from the Western Cape gives a sense that they support fragmentation that is constituted of 10 departments of health, each working independently as a universal model. My question to you is, how does Western Cape expect to achieve equity in the country by maintaining the system? My second question, Chairperson, the presentation appears to assume that none of the public hospitals will be contracted service providers under NHI. May I get some clarity on this particular, may I get clarity? May I get some clarity on this particularly in as far as the presenter's views, which suggest that a hospital service will only be limited to emergency medical services. What informs this position from Western Cape? My other question, Chairperson, your presentation has alluded to the WCD OH as a province that had innovations during COVID. Can the presentation confirm if these were not nationally integrated and managed together? And is this not what NHI will achieve if the whole country works together on one system? Lastly, Chairperson, with regard to the proposal made by Western Cape and concerns raised with respect to the centralized procurement processes, what does the Western Cape believe is the best way of amending the bill under Section 38? Thank you very much, Chairperson. Lastly, Chairperson, I know that during our visit to Western Cape during the NHI public hearing, people were complaining that Western Cape government were misleading people regarding the NHI processes. So, Sisnoma French, Benfumi has Uguti, Uteni Lendo, Benilasekisa, Abantu Baguti, Citizens and Ebil, ENG, RIT for Abantu Betuti Bonke, Bakon Uguti, Bafumane, Ezempilo, Ngokulinga nayo, but in the Western Cape, Nitate, Eyenu Indlela, as if Nina, you are not part of South Africa. So if ungan pendula apho njengongqongqoshe or umphathiswa wezempilo apho Western Cape ukuthi why you are misleading the people of South Africa, because we had many stories from people of Western Cape during the public hearing. Unfortunately, or fortunately, I was part of the public hearing and we had a lot of complaints. Naze nabasusa nabasa kwenye indawo nakupha nezenu ipamphlet information engekho relevant that was misleading the community of Western Cape. So if when you are answering my question, you can also cover that, ukuthi why are you doing that in the society of Western Cape? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. I have two questions. First one, procurement as described in Section 217.1 is different from buying products, which the providers should do themselves of the formulary at fixed national prices. How does WCG see this as a national risk? Second question, if central hospitals are national assets, why is the Western Cape DOH efforts to these being converted into government components that are accessible to all South Africans and managed in a manner that achieves UHC. Thank you.
Thank you very much, honorable members. Is there any other member that I would have left out who would want to raise any points here with the Western Cape government? Anyone at all? Let me also raise one or two points with your MEC and with your team. And before I do that, I must also say that I know that you actually accept that there will be an NHI, but that you have certain proposals to make, which you have actually made with regards to some of the points raised in the NHI bill. And it is very comforting to know that the Western Cape government supports the principle of the National Health Insurance. And what is before us now, of course, is the National Health Insurance Bill. And even that is very comforting to know that you do support the bill, apart from you making some points of concern, raising some points of concern and making certain proposals, which we have seen, or I have seen, and many of your slides which you presented. I want to also speak about your concern about the changing roles of the central hospitals and to acknowledge your concerns. Now, the white paper states that the structure and financing of central hospitals will be transformed into national assets, as well as training platforms, research hubs, and centers of excellence locally, regionally, and internationally. What is your view on the challenges that have been experienced by users, especially from rural provinces, who do not have sufficient access to central hospitals? This comes in relation with the point which was raised by Honorable Sukacha about the Eastern Cape and the Northern Cape, where we know that we have a referral system to the Western Cape, and I do remember it being in place even from as far afield as Namibia, even when I was a medical student and when I was working as a medical officer and subsequently. Would you agree with me that achieving equitable universal health coverage requires the provision of accessible healthcare services for the entire population without further imposing barriers? In absence of centralization of these hospitals, how do you suggest we address inequitable access to central hospitals? And how do we ensure that South Africans in need of specialist services are able to access such care within the context of geographic inequitable distribution? I now want to speak to the other point that you raised about the creation of contracting units for primary health care, as it is provided for under Section 37 of Chapter 8 of the Bill. A proposal is made to utilize the existing provincial structures, which are already overstretched. My question is, what will prevent the provinces from participating in the processes and activities of the proposed contracting units? And given that our public resources at provincial level are already overworked, how does the Western Cape see the proposal they have made materializing? And the very last point I'd like to raise with you is your intention or your motivation to serve as a laboratory and allow to be funded to invent the models as for the NHI. Now, we are aware that previously in reports which were made by the National Department of Health, the Western Cape has rejected almost all of the proposed national models, for example, the health patient registration system, the CC, MDD, quality programs, etc. How do you bring a relation between your proposal to serve as a laboratory towards the invention of the models with your previous rejections of the models which were put forward by the National Department of Health? I think those are all of the questions which all of the members would like to raise with yourselves. You're very welcome to reply, and we are actually looking forward to those replies. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Dr. Karim and Dr. Balaji will respond to the technicalities, but I'm just responding under general so that the members also can look in terms of what is currently happening in terms of the provisions within the current legislation. In regard to central hospitals, in case you are not aware that the provinces that do not have central hospitals, because remember, central hospitals have got a history in regard to that they are academic or teaching hospitals, and therefore find that they used to, at the time, focusing that they are attached to the medical schools. So, and also that quaternary service is related to that because there must be specialization and packages of different disciplines that needs to be offered. So those provinces like the Limpopo, Mpumalanga, I think you mentioned Northern Cape, you find that they do receive central hospital grants. They do receive, and I'm aware, for example, the Mpumalanga, that actually they the Gauteng invoiced them in regard to that aspect. So there is an offer in regard to that. In the Western Cape, the two central hospitals, which is the Fortescue and the Tigerberg, and then the tertiary hospital, the Red Cross as a children's hospital. Actually, the provision is there within even the National Health Act that they are catering beyond actually for the provinces, specifically from the Eastern Cape and also part of the Northern Cape in regard to Tigerberg, I think for Springbok in terms of the Northern Cape. So it has always been there. And also even the central grants that are being provided, the provinces, specifically Western Cape, has to provide more of the funding that comes from the equitable share for such. In addition to that, it was in the Eastern Cape, fortunately, from the Eastern Cape, and I also trained the Eastern Cape. We even have specialists, specifically, for example, for the pediatric oncologists that have got clinics on monthly basis where they'll go to Susila Makiwane, to and all of those in regard to that. So the current at Gauteng has got more, I think four or five, I can't remember the central hospitals that they have. So what we are trying to highlight is that every province that has got a central hospital, they do know that the central hospital is not for that province or is not for that specific area where the central hospital is allocated. That's why for Tigerberg, when we made the request to the National Treasury in regard to have a Tigerberg Regional Hospital to cut the Tigerberg, because currently, what is a central hospital? Because there's no regional hospital in that area, it means that it still has to service, especially the response in regard to the Khayelitsha, because the service is also part of the Metro East, in addition to other parts of the province and also other parts of the country, which is that's how things are in central hospital. Now, the question is about, why should it remain? The issue of the, as you see in the WHO is very clear about it, the issue of the continuity of care, because we're talking about preventive promotive, which is the primary healthcare part of it, and the intermediate care, which includes rehabilitative care, and the palliative care, the acute and subacute that are being catered for in level one, level two. And the majority of the poorest people, they ended up even having disabilities and also even deaths, early deaths, without even having been even able to access the central hospitals, which is the quaternary services. Therefore, the preventive and promotive and also the level one hospital, level two regional or provincial hospital, they have to still play a role, because actually the majority of the people That's where we find that they go to. And all these hospitals, they are part of the province. So the continuity of care is about, you cannot have one piece and then you have another piece as part of the continuation. Because when you track Auntie Sarah, when she enters the primary health care up to the level that she needs to have that heart transplant, it should be part of it, because you cannot be able to trace that person if it's open that now becomes segregated. And I was making an example of our specialists who now even have to go and have these clinics outside the Western Cape and assist and provide assistance to match their patients in those spaces out there. And then in regard to generally, again, about the NHI and UHC, I thought we made it clear that there's no one who can deny not to have universal health coverage. I even made an example up to where even as a country, through being guided by the national, we visited as many of the countries where we divided into groups and with the provinces visited these countries where we can be able to see lessons learned and then to customize ours. I made an example of going to Thailand and others went into the UK where they saw that in the social determinants of health, they could easily be actually be even added in terms of the included in terms of the of the costing, also of the budgeting. So we have never said that we are not supporting universal health coverage. And the question about the pamphlets, because we also need to be very careful, honorable member, when you say the people said about it, because one can also come and say that what the people said about that other person or those other people, the pamphlet what we're talking about, it is this pamphlet that we provided the people to summarize it for each and every person so that can understand exactly what is NHI, what is being offered, what is not being offered. So as we indicated earlier that about the issue of the universal coverage, that's part of it. There's no argument around that. Now the question related to, I think they can answer about some of those in regard to the purchasing and also the centralization and all of those, technically they could be able to answer that. But if I could also make more of the input in regard to that, to that space in terms of fragmentation, the bill, I still repeat, the bill, it's an insurance fund as it is written. If now this bill could be able to achieve what everyone is expecting, which is the UHC, bravo. That's why I was saying that in this form, it will never take us to the UHC. It won't. And as I highlighted in terms of what is the reason, because the focus is more on one aspect of the building block of the health system, which is more the financing and the funding. And I made an example that just like any other insurance, national health insurance, an insurance which is about where you create a fund and then all the monies are collected and then that fund buys for different packages of care. And we're already stating that even in those packages of care, nothing is being mentioned related to the upstream factors that impact on the care. We're even saying that the issue of the subsidiarity where the decisions supposed to be made at the local level. For example, for us, even without even mentioning the issue of the NHI and all of those, the decentralization and we're allowing things happening at that level, where, for example, the central hospital for level in terms of the post, they could be able to appoint, doesn't need an MEC or HOD as according to the PSA. It doesn't need. The issue of the budgeting, where you give budget to the hospital so that it doesn't have to wait to be actually in terms of approved at the head office in order to fix the window. There are many of those packages. They approve post list, where we have a post list so that that person management in that hospital, if now they lose a clinician or a specialist, they can make a decision regarding that we need to replace another person with this cardiologist where probably there's no need, instead of probably appointing maybe two or three MOs or maybe 10 or health professionals, nurses and other categories if need be. The point that I'm trying to make is that already the current system does allow that things can happen there at the territory, at the district, or at the sub-district level. And in terms of the PFFA, the accounting officer, the HOD, has not only to account, has also taken the responsibility. Now, if you're going to all the funding is being centralized elsewhere, what we're saying is that this will not work when we are still have to be responsible in terms of the delivery of the care services. And if you look in terms of what is being said about the provinces, that the limitations will be in the EMS, for example, when you talk about the issue of the EMS and all of those and other aspects. So the side cannot divide the continuation of the rendering of the services. And also lastly, the building blocks, as you are aware, we talk about the health financing, the information systems, leadership and governance, the human resource, the package of care, the care that you provide, it's all based on these building blocks. You cannot take one system to be there at the national level. You take another part of the health system, another building block there, because everything must be within. But what we are saying is that we understand the limitations that is being provided in the National Health Act, where it states it's clear that the National Department of Health Responsibility is more on the norms and standards and the policies. They don't own hospitals, they don't own patients, they don't own human resource. It's done by the provinces. Therefore, it makes them to be in a difficult position where they have to make some of the inputs, especially when the health system is collapsing. Therefore, there is a need that they're supposed to be part of it. That's why we're saying that let's not create binaries. Similar with the private health, no one is happy. No one is happy in regard to when the people ended up not being able to get a service because of affordability. And also, we don't want where there's an exchange of money at the point of service. The prepayment is where to go. Internationally, that's what is happening. 26 of the countries already, they have implemented the UHC. We have to do and customize our own UHC. The private, I listen to the private. Actually, I've had even engagements and the seminars and the symposium with the private. They are very well much welcoming the issue of the UHC because lastly, Chair, at the end, the contribution that goes to the private, mostly from the medical schemes, the majority of those medical aids are mostly those that are coming subsidized by the government, and most of them in order for them for their livelihood. And that money comes from who? From us. If you look in terms of the public servants that we have that are on medical aid, which is they contribute towards that side, there's a lot that money could be done. So, Chair, I'll ask now the team just to contribute, and then I might come back about the other specifics. Thank you. Over to you, Dr. KV.
Thanks, Minister. Just to pick up from where you left off, Minister, so just to... And just pardon me if I don't cover all the ground, but I'm sure Dr. Karim will also come in. I think the issue of several of the questions related to issues of fragmentation, 9 provinces, etc. And I think at no stage are we saying that we don't believe in one national health system, that we are all part of one national health system, and the intent of pooling resources from the public and private sector to try and achieve the best possible population health outcomes is completely supported. Right? So I think that's a very important statement to make at the outset. So one is not, espousing a kind of fragmented system and each province does its own thing, etc. We are part of a national health system. And in fact, the national department should be setting the national policy for the country, the national direction for the country, the health reform agenda for the country, and we should be buying into that. We should be co-developing that, right? And we should co-commit to implementing that over the next many years. So I think I want to just make that point strongly at the outset. I think having said that, right, the issue of, cohesive health systems is a hell of an important thing, right? And like I said in the presentation, we have spent decades trying to build a cohesive health system where the different parts talk to each other. Patients have been referred thousands of times every day between facilities, right? And the ability to maintain that cohesion, to strengthen the relationships between the different parts, to be enabled and supported is hell of a important to be a well-performing health system. And we say that any reforms that goes against that will fragment that cohesion and undermine the performance and achievement of a health system. That's what we are saying, right? I also want to say the point about we don't in the Western Cape profess to have mastered the leadership in health reform, or that we don't have problems to solve, or we are completely 100% all sorted out in the Western Cape. That's never been a pronouncement from the department, and we don't say that at all. I mean, we've got our fair share of challenges in the province. Of course, there are equity issues in the province that need to be addressed. There are efficiencies that can be improved. There are quality of care improvements that can still happen. There are many innovations still to happen. And the reform process with all of this is a lifelong journey. It's an ongoing journey of improvement that we committed to. So we don't profess to know it all and have all the answers to all the problems. What we say is that we have a process where we can co-commit to jointly solving these problems, jointly sharing what we have experienced and share that across provinces as well as between national and the province. And that's the approach we would like to take. So one of the questions was about, you know, what are the collaborative efforts with national? And what we're suggesting is that this NHI bill process is an important opportunity for that engagement to happen and build on what we have. And the last 2 years has been an excellent example of collaborating and working together. It's been an excellent example of taking some of the principles of UHC forward, with way the vaccines have been procured for the whole country, right? With the way public and private have worked together at an operational level, sharing of data, joint problem solving, et cetera. And it bodes well for the future. And that's what we need to build on going forward. So I think that's just as an example of the collaborative effort. But we must convene and create the process and the environment for that robust engagement to take this process forward. On the issue of Honorable Chair, your point about some of the projects that have been rejected in inverted commas. I think rejection is a strong word. I think there are where there's been engagement still to be had is that in the Western Cape, we've had long years of establishing certain systems. And the question is, how does one switch, or how does one make the transition smoother between different systems? Or how does one interoperate different systems, as opposed to all of us, dismantling what we have built over years and committing to something new? So the HPRS is a good example. So it's a health performance registration system that the national department has created. We've said we've had a system that has gone for 10, 15 years of the way we've registered our patients. We have a data center. We have a patient master index, and that has worked well, et cetera. And we've collaborated with national to share our data set with national to see how we can make this interoperable. Right? And I think that's an important principle going forward, Honorable Chair, because especially in the IT space, there are going to be a lot of IT applications, and every province has histories and different systems that have been tried, etc. How do we create a transition towards an interoperable national health system where we can seamlessly share data and achieve the same purpose? So that's just as an example. I think those would be the main points. Minister, you covered many of the other areas, especially the central hospitals and those issues. I think let me stop there, Honorable Chair, and I'm not sure if Dr. Karim would like to add.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. Maybe just one or two points from my side to pick up where Dr. Balaji left off. I'll get my camera up and running. Here we go. Honorable Chair, so I think the one big
definitional issue that we also have been grappling with, as I'm sure you have, is the stewardship role of the provinces. Now, I mean, we've had experience, as Minister pointed out during the COVID pandemic, of playing that stewardship role in the province, not just for the public health, but for public and private. As you might know, we had entered into contractual agreements with the private sector hospital groups in the province, the medical schemes, to provide healthcare as a composite basket of healthcare, public and private. So I think the issue of the stewardship role of the provincial department of health is actually quite critical. But then also in looking at the definition, it will be important then to distinguish the stewardship role from the purchaser, the provider, and even the regulatory role. And I think those distinctions, if they're quite clear, could in fact enhance and strengthen the position. I think the Minister and Dr. Balaji both spoken about the UHC, and that's always been the position of the province, you know, is that we are wanting to move towards UHC. And even as we said in the introduction, the innovations brought upon during COVID, in fact, are taking us along that path towards UHC. There was one question, for example, about some of those innovations. And we were talking about the kind of innovations brought upon, like telehealth. We discovered, for example, that diabetics are higher risk of dying from COVID. So we instituted a telehealth system to help diabetics and understand their risk factors. And in fact, it showed significant reduction in mortality. We instituted a system of delivering chronic medication to people's homes. We've delivered about 3 million patient medicine parcels to people's homes over the two-year period so that they don't have to come into the hospitals and queue and stand in long queues just to pick up their medication. So a number of those innovations, but all of those in a sense are action areas that we've identified towards UHC, and those can be summarized as our service delivery capability. We also have, as Dr. Balaji and Minister pointed out, governance capability and defining the roles of the various role players, public and private stewardship in the province. And if we look at the workforce capability and our learning capability, those are kind of the action areas or pillars, if you like, of our thinking towards UHC. And so when we talk about being a laboratory for that, I mean, we certainly have, we believe in the province, the strength of all four of those action areas to be able to help us understand how UHC is to be delivered. And Minister already spoken about the NHI itself being largely a financing mechanism. And that's where we had some of the concerns, obviously, that Dr. Balaji raised. Thank you, Chair. I mean, just to add to the conversation.
Thank you very much. MEC, are you coming to have that second opportunity as you said you would?
Chair, I think they covered everything, but it's... I think what I wanted to stress, because there was a question about what will be the packages that the provinces is being proposed to provide within the NHI, the emergency medical services and forensic pathology services, which currently is the case. And noting that the EMS, based on the 1977 Dispensation Health Act, they were also under the metros, which is, I'm sure, I'm thinking Gauteng, some of them, they are still, some of them are still under the metrics. But it's in terms of the constitution, in terms of the schedules, but it's a provincial function. Forensic pathology services, as I think Dr. Balaji indicated, that they were transferred from the police to the provinces. And I recall that the person, although I wasn't here before, the person who was actually spearheading, it was convening, it was the DDG, Dr. Nicholas Christou, was influential in terms of transferring this during the time. The Environmental and Pollution Control Services, which is, according to the National Health Act, they are municipal services, and also specifically for the district and the national. And then the Health and Medical Services during provincial disasters. That's the only function. Now, if you, because I always make an example of track down anti-SARA patient aid. So in terms of the NHI bill, it says that there might be that service provider that will have been appointed by the national in order to provide that service. So anti-SARA will go to that clinic, and the clinic or whatever, it could be private, that provides such a basic, maybe primary healthcare services as accordingly. And then if it happens that anti-SARA has got an issue with that kind of a service there, It means that there must be, or there should be, or there could be, or there might be a complaint line that will go directly to the province. Because if the province is not in charge, is not a steward in regard to the care that is happening inside their province, it means that all the complaints from the Maritzburg and whatever, they'll go to the national. Because for the province, they'll say, if it's not EMS, if it's not forensic, if it's not about disaster, then we are tied. So that's why we're saying that once we encourage the whole system to work as one, because when we say UK system, NHS, when we say that it's a whatever system in every country, we talk about one country, not segregation. So that's why we're saying that one health system, well, the difference between the governance, but we talk about the system, one health system with a multiple entries so that it provides different needs for the different people as they require without financial hardship. And also for the choice, if others have, they've got affordability where they can put the frills. But we as a government, because we have to absorb and to protect the vulnerables, therefore, that's why I was saying that it's long overdue to pulling the resources and see how each and every sphere could be able to work towards universal health coverage. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, MST. I was just about to stop you, but thank you very much. We've come to the end of the presentation by the Western Cape government. We appreciate you coming to make your input here to us as the members of the Portfolio Committee on Health. We would have to move on, honorable members. You are very welcome, MEC and your team, to stay on should you wish to, but you're also welcome to leave the platform since you are very busy people, but it's entirely up to yourselves. We are going to have next a representation from SALDA, and they will be led by Ms. Nosibele Makanda. And you're very welcome to introduce your team, Ms. Makanda, and also whoever will be doing your presentation. And I hope you've already been, yes, I see you have already been made a co-host. So very welcome to our committee. It's a continuation of a meeting of this morning. We have spelled out the rules of our meeting, not for your purpose only now, but for everybody's purpose. And we're looking forward to your presentation. Thank you. You may continue.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. And I'm not sure if I should straightway share my screen. Let me just quickly share my presentation.
I'm only concerned you're still moving. I hope you don't get cut off at some stage. I see your vehicle is moving.
Yes, I am. I am a bit on the road, Honorable Chairperson, but I'm confident that the network will carry me through. Chairperson, I was supposed to be with Councillor Stan Ramaila, the National Chairperson, responsible for the municipal health services in SALDA, in the NEC of SALDA. But he's going to be joining me, and his voice is held up in another meeting of the municipality. And so it is just me for now, and I'll be presenting on behalf of SALDA. And if he joins me, then you will be able to then respond and maybe comment as in the course of the discussion. So I am ready to present. And greetings to you, Honorable Chairperson, and the Honorable members of the committee, the Honorable Minister and the MECs that are present, and all the colleagues from the National Department of Health. I see the acting editor of the Office of DG. Honorable Chairperson, as SALDA, I wish to present as follows, just the under definitions. The comments that we wish to bring forward that the one, the bill defines healthcare services as meaning A, healthcare services including the reproductive healthcare system, or let me just put it on, including reproductive healthcare and emergency medical treatment contemplated in Section 27 of the Constitution, and B, basic nutrition and basic healthcare services contemplated in Section 28(1). And C of the Constitution, and under C, medical treatment contemplated in Section 35, subsection 2, subsection E of the Constitution, and D, where section, and it appears in this bill that the municipal healthcare services could mean something different to municipal health services as defined in section 1 of the National Health Act number 61 of 2003. Again, under the application of the Act, section 3, subsection 1 of the bill states that the Act applies to all health establishments, excluding military health services and establishments, while section 3, subsection 4 of the bill states that the Act does not in any way amend, change or affect the funding and functions of any organ or state in respect of healthcare services until legislation contemplated in section 77 and 214 read with section 227 of the Constitution and any other relevant legislation has been enacted or amended. Our comment on this one, on the application of the Act as well, is that our interpretation is that the Act applies to health services and establishment at local government level. It is our view that the implementation of the National Health Insurance will require addressing health infrastructure and human resources for health, amongst other things. It has been noted that some municipalities currently have health establishments in the form of clinics, which may require infrastructure improvement and additional human resources for health for them to meet the standards required for accreditation health service providers. Local governments will also be required to provide and coordinate services such as water sanitation, waste management, energy and access roads aimed at enabling the efficient provision of health services. It must therefore be noted that both the preparation of the implementation of NHI and the actual implementation of the NHI will require more funding than what is currently allocated to local governments. It is therefore urged that the NHI bill highlights the need for the review of the appropriation, equity of share and grant to the local sphere. On roles, Honorable Chairperson, Section 31, Subsection A of the bill under the general provisions applicable to the operation of the fund, clearly outlines the role of the minister as including governance and stewardship of the national health system, while Section 31, Subsection 2 of the bill says that the minister must lead in appropriate legislation the respective roles and responsibilities of the fund. Section 32 of the bill clearly outlines the role of the national department and further indicates what must happen with the provincial department in as far as its role is concerned. SALGA's comment on the roles, therefore, is that we understand that the National Health Insurance is a health financing system. However, we note that the bill also provide of health services. Both the National Health Act number 61 and the 2018 National Health Insurance Bill clearly outline the role of local government in the provision of health services. SALGA notes the exclusion of the role of local government in the current National Health Insurance Bill. SALGA is of the view that municipal health services form part of the country's health system, and therefore the minister must clearly delineate in appropriate legislation the respective roles and responsibilities of municipalities, as it is the case with the respective roles and responsibilities of the fund and the national and provincial departments, taking into consideration the Constitution, this Act, and the National Health Act. The Act must also stipulate the role of municipalities, if any, or what will happen under the contracting unit for primary health care. Section 37, subsection 1, subsection A, states that a contracting unit for primary health care establishment in terms of section 31B of the National Health Act manages the provision of primary health care services such as prevention, promotion, curative, rehabilitative, ambulatory, home-based care, and community care in a demarcated geographical area. While Section 2 indicates that the contracting unit for primary health care must be comprised of a And our comments as well on this one is that it must be noted that the local government played a critical role in the piloting of the National Health Insurance. The environmental health practitioners employed by local government constituted the ward-based outreach team and played a critical role in cases, investigations, and in the addressing of environmental health conditions impacting on the health of the citizens. The number of environmental health care practitioners currently employed by national, provincial, and local governments is far less than the number recommended by the World Health Organization and the standard prescribed in the National Health and Environmental Health Policy, which is prescribing one environmental health practitioner per 10,000 population members.
And Ms. Can I just make a statement? Since I did raise, I do see you in the passenger seat. I would assume you don't have a left-hand drive vehicle, so there is a concern by some of the members that you are actually traveling. While doing your presentation, you must ensure or confirm with us you are not actually driving.
No, not driving.
And secondly, if possible, that you should pull over to do this presentation. You're about halfway, so you can consider from our side as the portfolio committee. We want to be certain that you are not putting yourself and others at risk. Thank you.
Thank you, and I will have a considered. I will ask my driver to pull over as soon as we are safe. It is safe to do so. Thank you very much. But rest assured, I am not driving, and we are going to slow down a bit so that you can pull over.
Yes, and another comment, you must please put your seatbelt on. I'm sorry, I'm translating. I'm relaying the messages. Don't shoot the messenger. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Okay. Well, back to the comments of Salka on this section. The environmental health care practitioners employed by government. Oh, I'm sorry. I was on bullet number 3 in terms of the capacity challenges of the environmental health practitioners to deal with the current demands of the sector. So the recruitment of environmental health practitioners should be prioritized together with the recruitment of other health professionals in preparation of the full implementation of NHI. So this is our submission on this part. And then on the repeal or amendment of laws, Chairperson, the National Health Act number 61 of 2003. The amendment of this act of 2003 proposes insertion of section 31A and subsection 1 of which seeks to establish the district health management offices as national government components to, among other functions, manage provisions of non-professional health services in the district. And our comment as well on this one is that municipalities are currently providing non-personal health services in the form of municipal health services. That the municipal health services as defined in section 1 of the National Health Act, number 61 of 2003, includes water quality monitoring, food control, waste management, health surveillance of premises, surveillance and prevention of communicable diseases, excluding immunization, vector control, environmental pollution control, disposal of the dead, and chemical safety. The bill should therefore clearly define the non-personal health to be managed by the district health management offices to prevent fragmentation and duplication of non-personal health services. The last part, Honorable Chairperson, as we conclude, is that we believe the successful implementation of the National Health Insurance will require intergovernmental and multi-sectoral approach, and to that effect, local government plays a critical role in addressing social determinants of health and in contributing towards improved health outcomes and the long and healthy life of all South Africans. Strengthening environmental health programs such as health surveillance of premises, surveillance and prevention of communicable diseases, waste management, food control, vector control, and environmental pollution control are essential. At all service levels. The implementation of the National Health Insurance should take into account.
Chair, I'm not sure if I'm the only one who's lost the presenter, but I've lost her completely.
Yes, Ms. Nosibele, are you back?
Yes, I'm in. Okay, it's the weather now. But the last part of the sentence that Honourable members may have missed is the last bite that says we require the implementation of the national health insurance that would take into account the inputs that have been listed and to ensure a unified health system and the realization of Section 27 of the Constitution of the country, the SDGs and the NDP goals as it relates to the universal health coverage. Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. That is the end of the presentation.
Thank you very much for your presentation. And I'm sorry I made you lose some time on reaching your destination. But
thank you.
Appreciate you coming here today and your willingness to come and do this presentation. So we do have some members who would want to raise some questions. I don't have anyone yet. One so far, Honorable Howard would like to ask a question. Honorable members, you can indicate here for me if you'd like to ask any questions or raise any questions with Salda.
Thank you, Chair, and also thank you, presenter. I just have one question. Can you clarify to the committee the difference between municipal health care services and municipal health service and the sections or clauses in the bill where the two may have been conflated? Thank you.
Thank you. Any other members who'd want to ask any questions?
Yes, Chair, I do.
Please go ahead, Honorable Gela.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me welcome the presentation from SALGA. I've got two questions that I want to ask SALGA. The first one, is there a provision of healthcare services by municipalities funded or an unfunded mandate? In slide 5, you state some municipalities currently have health establishments in the form of clinics. They have no statutory mandate for this function. So now they want to offload the services, but with no budget transfer with the function shift. This is not acceptable. As an example, the city of Cape Town has over 120 of these clinics, which basically add to the budget and capacity of the Western Cape Department of Health. The salaries of staff employed by municipalities are different and higher. What is SALGA proposing in terms of how these services can be funded and harmonized? The second question, there has previously been an effort to provincialism the personal health care services delivered by the municipality. In your view, what has been a bottleneck in achieving this goal? What are your proposal on how this can be affected? Should you be in agreement with the provincialization? Lastly, Chairperson, can the presenter clarify if municipalities will be interested in moving their infrastructure to the province system for the current unfunded mandates.
Thank you very much, honorable members. I will also raise some questions, and I had specifically noted, Ms. Makanda, you're talking about two things here, the municipal health care services and the municipal health service, and that you are asking the question whether these are two different things or whether this is supposed to mean one thing. And if you can maybe clarify for us the difference between those two and your views on those, as well as the sections of clauses in the bill where the two may have been conflated, it would really assist us. And in terms of your understanding of SALGA's mandate, or with regards to municipal health services, I remember a time when there were municipal health clinics, and we still find them in the larger cities or in cities, in metros. And I do remember even where I lived, there used to be health services provided by municipalities, and then it was removed and taken over by the provinces. So in my understanding of this, I would like to be then informed, but more informed of my, of your view rather, of the definition of the National Health Act of 2003 with regards to this municipal health services, which should be rendered at a municipal health level, and especially Chapter 5, Section 32 of the same Act. Do you suppose that these could be regarded as personal health care services that are to be funded through the NHI? And then you also raised in your presentation issues related to the provincialization of health services and the devolution of environmental health services. We've had a presentation by the Western Cape government, and especially the Department of Health, which spoke to the same point of the type of services. So what is your view as SALGA of these two, having considered current policy on the two and long-standing problems that have not been resolved that pertain to environmental health services and offices? And your presentation is motivating for infrastructure budget from the NHI fund. Do I understand you correctly? Thank you very much. Those are the only questions which will be asked to you this afternoon. We do appreciate you coming to present, and if you can please respond to those questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, and I appreciate the questions as they are coming. Am I audible?
You are. You audible?
Thank you, Chairperson. It's under definitions, Chairperson. On the first question that deals with the difference between municipal healthcare services and municipal services. So what we want to bring in under definition is also something that clearly states municipal health services as well, because under municipal it's section 3.1 that defines the application of this, and let me just go to the comments. So it's under definition under A, B, and C. So what we are recommending there, Chairperson, is that we believe that municipal health services are as they're contained in the National Environmental Health in the National Health Act 1, and as they deal with the municipal health services as provided by local government. Then municipal health care services, or the services that are located within the municipal jurisdiction that are offering care services to the community. And such would then also include the services that are offered through the healthcare services that are offered by local municipalities in terms of the primary healthcare. And but when we talk municipal health services broadly, we also believe that such should also involve environmental health care as well, as already defined in the Act, and the provision of the services that I had outlined. Then under the area of the healthcare services by municipalities as an unfunded mandate by the question by Honorable Geller. Indeed, currently, the process of provincialization was done, and so the healthcare function was taken from local government and returned back to the provincial government. But that process in metros did not happen, so the metros are still funding are still carrying out the primary healthcare function with all the clinics and the healthcare establishment run by the metro. And part of the challenges that are there, indeed, the metros are spending from the municipal funds more than the allocation that they are getting from the provincial government in terms of providing the primary health care. And they have come because of the level of infrastructure, as well as assets in terms of human resource that they have put into the system. In the period of transition in the provincialization, it became clear that... it became clear, Honorable Chairperson, that process, the disagreements between the provinces and the metros in terms of the running of the healthcare function, in terms of the personnel and the levels of scale at which the personnel were at metros versus where they would be going into the provincial department. There was then an agreement between the provinces and the metros to have the metros running the function. Indeed, it is a fact that it continues being an unfunded mandate because it is not the function of the municipality, but they have a service level agreement with the metros. And maybe to link that to the next question that says, what becomes SALGAV's proposal for funding and harmonization between the functions as provided by the provinces as well as by the metros? Then the proposal would be that the funds must follow the function, and that on the assessment of how of what the function is costing the metros, then the allocation of the funding should also be commensurate with that. And possibly that because at this point it would seem that the department in provinces as well as the metros that are rendering the service, there is an agreement that it is better served. The interests of the communities are better served where the services are located at the metros, of course, with the allocations by the provinces. But then we would just, as far as I would call for, an allocation that would meet all the funding requirements of the service so that it does not have to take from the municipal funding to also fund the sourcing, the resourcing of the service. Then again, the area on bottlenecks in terms of the primary healthcare services transfer between from the metro. In fact, I can assure the portfolio committee that with the districts, because the function was rendered by the district, and some districts were having service level agreements with the local municipalities, but all of that has been taken over by the provinces. So the local government is now rendering the primary healthcare services in metros, so the bottlenecks are only in as far as because I don't think right now we have not really I think we left the discussion with the Department of Health hanging in terms of really taking over the function and having the function fully provincialized from the metros, and so the metros are still running with the function. Now the only thing then that we're saying is that so that it does not continue becoming a burden to the metros, the funding, the required funding must be allocated to the metros so that they are able to render and also to be supported in the rendering of the function. Of course, there is a good relationship between the province and the metros as it were now. As far as the municipal assets are concerned, I think it was one of the challenges, Honorable Chairperson, that the municipalities have invested deeply into the assets for the primary health care. And now the taking over of such, the handing over of such assets, there was no agreement in terms of the municipalities being compensated for the assets that they've bought and accumulated over time, as well as the human resource aspects. Because as it turns out, apparently, as I've said earlier, the metros are paying the healthcare providers at a higher scale than the normal clinics that are run by the Department of Health. And so we could not really reach an agreement in terms of that, that would make the transition therefore happen to the provincial departments. As far as the primary healthcare services that are rendered by metros is concerned, for the communities, it makes sense for that service to be rendered by local government. It makes sense, but we understand fully that it is not our core function and it is not our mandate, in fact, as local government. And so the function is being rendered on behalf of the provincial government and hence the service level agreements that are there. And of course, when we're referring to the infrastructure that then is there, in terms of both the municipal healthcare services as run by the metros, perhaps then it would be to say so that they are not, the infrastructure meets the standard of the national healthcare, national health insurance, then the metros or rather local government would also need to have such funding for that would also improve the infrastructure to reach that level, so that they are not as indicated in the presentation, they are not they remain the service provider. They continue to play the role of being the service provider. And indeed, so part of that infrastructure definitely is dealing with the healthcare centers, the clinics. And as far as the municipal health care, municipal health services, as indicated to providing, let me just quickly go to the slide, to providing water quality monitoring, food control, waste management, health surveillance of premises, surveillance and prevention of communicable disease, and as well as vector control and environmental pollution control, with the disposal of the dead and chemical safety. Again, the municipalities are responsible for that funding, but the funding from the equitable share is not adequate, and sometimes it is a challenge that was brought to the attention of the at a national level, where we had a national health Indaba on the 28th to the 30th of September, where we partnered with the National Department of Health, we brought in National Treasury and COCTA, so as to discuss this whole issue of the funding and the capacity challenges that are faced by local government and that have been exposed mainly by COVID, with the outbreak of COVID, wherein the ability of the environmental healthcare function in preventing communicable diseases, that would also have helped a great deal in preventing the spread of COVID-19 if there was adequate capacity. And the funding currently, in the allocation of the funding to the municipality, the allocated budget to the actual service sometimes is not as demanded by the service. So as part of the healthcare system, we believe that the municipal health services, in as far as environmental health services, should also be considered and funded under the national health insurance funding, so as to be able to to be the standard that the World Health Organization wants it to be at. I hope I have covered all the questions, Chairperson.
Yes, I think so. Thank you very much. I'm trying to understand what you are actually really raising, and it's not difficult what you are raising, but I'm trying to get it into context. You are saying there are services being rendered at the primary healthcare level clinics which are then managed at the local government level and especially in the metros. You are saying that funds should follow function. And you are also saying, therefore, that, and my question would be whether you would then be able to participate in the NHI as either SALDA or as the clinics. But I'm going to put this much more clearer to you just now. So what is your view, what will happen to the health facilities, for example, under the control of local government now, as well as the assets and liabilities linked to primary healthcare services, since we're now talking about this? You've also mentioned that there has been an indaba around this, and that there hadn't been final conclusions around the same topic. Now, this was supposed to have taken place, and I'm talking here about the transfer of the facilities, the assets, the liabilities, etc. was supposed to have happened in 2003. But what I do also understand is that NHI will purchase from any provider that is accredited. So my understanding is that this bill does not prohibit local government from managing clinics, and that is already in the National Health Act. Does it then also mean that SALDA, if you are saying what you are saying, will support a situation where the NHI fund will contract directly with the clinics belonging to the metros? Or what is your view in terms of that? And if that should happen, it would mean that the budget will be going directly to the clinics and not to the municipalities. So it'd be important and very interesting to hear what you would say about those points. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Again, in terms of this one, I think what
your network has frozen. I'll give you a few seconds. Ms. Nozibela. I would have loved to have heard the views of Ms. Nozibela Makanda on this one. Honorable members, you are back. We are ahead of time, so give an opportunity to reconnect.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm back. I don't know what is happening with the network now, because for a while it was fine. What I'm saying, Chairperson, then, is that if the NHI on the assessment of the function as rendered by the clinics and with the agreement between the metros and the provinces is heavy to fund directly to the clinics, as will support that, because what is important is for the adequate service to the community that would meet the standards as required by the NHI. And if we need funding, then for funding to also upgrade those facilities to meet that standard would have to go directly to those facilities under the auspices of local government, being, of course, having a service level agreement with the province. We do not have a problem with that. And I think because through the as part of cooperative governance, but the issue is, if then the burden becomes on the municipalities, they have to continue funding far and over and above what is allocated. Of course, there is a portion that the municipalities have taken responsibilities on, the metros in particular, are taking responsibilities on over and above what is allocated by the provincial departments where the primary healthcare services is rendered by local government. And but now, with the continuous underfunding of the municipalities is burdensome to the metros. And hampers their ability to deliver quality service that would be that would meet the requirements of NHI. So we would want that part of the funding should take that into consideration. And of course, I think if the transfer of assets were to be a requirement and between the provinces and the metros, then obviously all the implications would have to be discussed, and so that a budget would be set aside that would take care of all the implications of either the transfer of human resources or of the assets and liabilities, of course. And then SALGA would be happy to participate in that discussion and would be happy to provide what would make sense for local government, but would also equally be happy to have local government as one of the service providers allowed, of course, the mandate not being that of local government, but with a service level agreement. We would be happy to participate in this as local government if our metros still feel comfortable that they have the capacity to deliver on the service, on the function, and they are getting the requisite allocation of funding.
Thank you very much, Ms. Makanda. We appreciate you coming and taking your time to come and present to us. I just want to make certain that there is no one else who would want to raise anything with you. I think just before we finish up with you, any last final words you want to say to us?
An appreciation of this kind of a discussion and obviously the engagement. But what we also really would want the Portfolio Committee on Health to also really bring into the bill is the significance of municipal health services into the prevention of disease spread and control in communities through the work that the environmental health practitioners do, and how such the capacitation of such would improve the health of the community on the preventive aspect, so that the preventive aspect is equally or almost equally funded as well as the curative aspect. And we believe that as SALGA, if the preventive aspect of health is given as much attention as the curative aspect, the desired outcomes would be a reduction on the need to fund the curative aspects of health, as prevention we believe is better than cure. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. And I like your closing argument there for prevention. Of course, the basics are very important. And we thank you very much for coming. Honorable members, we are going to try to move on. You are welcome to stay.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the opportunity.
You will be leaving your place where you are parked. We will continue because our committee secretary has informed me that life healthcare does have its representatives already on the platform. They were to have done their presentation at 18:15, and we would appreciate it if they'd be able to indulge us with starting a bit earlier. I believe their group CEO, who is Peter Wharton Wood, is on our platform. If he is leading this delegation, would you please indicate to me and also indicate whether you are ready to commence with your presentation. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Honorable Chairman, Dr. Jacobs. Yes, I am Peter Wharton Wood, the Group Chief Executive. I am leading the delegation from Life Healthcare this afternoon, and a warm welcome to the honorable members of the Health Portfolio Committee. If I may introduce my delegation, Honorable Chairman.
You're very welcome, and after that, you may continue with your presentation.
Thank you very much. I've asked them to switch their cameras on for the purposes of the introduction. I'm joined today by my Life Healthcare colleagues, Mr. Adam Pyle, Chief Executive Officer of our South African operations, Dr. Sharon Basuthavan, Executive Head of Education, Mr. Andre Joseph, General Manager, Funder Relations, Mr. Amrita Raniga, our Health Policy Manager, Mr. Ridwan Jabbar, Head of Funders, Analytics and Product Disruption, and Mrs. Ansuye Padiachi, who's Head of our External and Community Affairs. Thank you, Honourable Chairman and members of the Portfolio Committee, for allowing us the opportunity to make this important presentation to you today. And I thank you too for accommodating the diary request that we put to the Honourable Members earlier in this month to accommodate the meeting with our shareholders in the form of our annual general meeting, which took place earlier today. Honourable Chairman, if I may move forward into our presentation, please, and I'll ask my colleagues to switch their cameras off, and they will switch them back on as and when they make their respective contributions to this afternoon's proceedings. In the context of life healthcare, if I look at the agenda that we will follow during the course of our presentation, Amrita will bring the slides up for me. You'll see that I will present an overview, and then we'll move through the various stages of our presentation. I won't read the slide off because it will become apparent during the course of the presentation, and I will wrap up in the shape and form of a conclusion. If I commence with Life Healthcare's overview, you'll see that our ambition statement that we have made to shareholders and all stakeholders alike is that we will be an international healthcare provider, and I stress the word international, that plays out in some of the logic we bring to you a little later, providing and delivering measurable clinical quality through a diversified offering and a people-centered approach. Our mission: we improve the lives of people through the delivery of high quality and cost-effective care. All of those words also important to today's contribution. And our overall purpose, which many have heard, is making life better. If I continue to just put life healthcare into perspective, it is often mistaken as a purely South African hospital group. And yes, we have an extensive footprint in South Africa. We manage and are responsible for 66 healthcare facilities across our country, across 7 provinces of South Africa and Botswana. We are also the largest provider of employer-based on-site healthcare and other industry-related services. But our differentiator, which will bring a different nuance and subtlety to some of the points we make, is that our international business, through our wholly owned subsidiary, the Alliance Medical Group, is the leading provider of imaging services to governments, and I stress the word governments, across that of the United Kingdom, Italy, and Ireland, with a further participation in 10 countries. And I'd like to dwell on this slide just for a moment, Honourable Chair, because we stand in front of you as one of the most important providers in the shape and form of public-private partnership to the National Health Service in the United Kingdom, to the government of Ireland, and to the government of Italy. We've contracted with them to provide and provision a substantial service to them. And we've done it with the highest quality, on an extremely efficient basis, and at the lowest cost. When each one of those countries, we as a private healthcare provider, charge the same rates as the state would charge the citizens of the country. For me, this is an important emphasis, because as a group chief executive of a South African listed healthcare company, I speak with pride and with confidence with the work that we have delivered to 3 very well-run and very important governments. And I stand today in front of you, representing our listed company, knowing that we wish to be able to do the same. It disappoints me that we haven't been able to include the South African government as one of our partners of substance in the diagnostic and imaging services delivery process that we've already proven internationally. And we hope, through the context of our conversation today, that our plea to be able to participate and help goes recognized, and we are able to activate it as this process moves forward. I will now hand over to Adam Pyle, the Chief Executive of our South African operations, to continue with the domestic overview. Adam?
Thank you, Pete. Can you all see me, Pete?
We can, yes. I will switch my camera off.
Thank you, Pete, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. So in terms of Peter's covered our international overview, and in terms of South Africa, you know, our business has various categories to it. We are primarily in an acute hospital business with 49 acute hospitals across various provinces in the country. We also have a what we call a complementary services line, which consists of the mental health business, the acute physical rehabilitation business, and then renal dialysis and oncology. In addition to that, we have a healthcare services business, which consists of two quite different businesses. One is the we call Life Health Solutions, which is fundamentally an occupational health and wellness business. And then we have our public-private partnership, Life Estimeni, with 10 facilities and over 3,000 beds. In addition to that, we have our nursing education asset, which sadly is an underutilized asset at the moment. It consists of our Life College of Learning with its 7 learning centers across the country. And, you know, historically, we used to train close to, 1,500 nurses every year. And we are currently training about 20% of that number. And later in this presentation, Sharon Vasudevan will go into a bit more detail in this regard. You go on to the next slide, please, Amrita. So I'd like to, first of all, reaffirm from a life healthcare perspective our support for NHI, our support for universal healthcare, and our support for improving the access to quality healthcare and improving the actual overall quality of healthcare for all South Africans. And, I do want to say that from a life healthcare perspective, we are providers of healthcare, whether that be imaging overseas or acute hospitals in South Africa. And I'd also like to think that we are pretty good at what we do in terms of that delivery. What we are not, though, are health policy experts. So please take our comments as regard national health insurance from whence they come. Secondly, I'd also like to make the point that when we make our comments on NHI, we do not presume that the private healthcare sector is perfect, because we know it's not. It is a fragmented system. It has challenges as regards cost. There's challenges as regard resources, and we know we don't treat enough people within the system. Our view here on NHI is that the NHI initiative is the largest undertaking ever taken by a government. It is going to require a massive change to the underlying health system. This change is complex, and for NHI to achieve its objectives, it's going to require a number of, how shall I frame it, building blocks to be in place if we're going to improve the access to healthcare and the quality of healthcare. And in this regard, we believe that if we're going to accelerate the implementation of NHI, the public and private sectors need to work together, and private sectors should be involved. And the private sector should be involved not just in terms of private sector capacity, but in various other ways. And we will touch a number of those ways throughout this presentation. In addition, we believe the single payer system creates not just enormous concentration, but we believe it creates enormous operational risk to the NHI system. And we believe this risk is unnecessary. And our proposal is that you can still have a single fund, but one should have, though, a multi-payer system to alleviate some of that operational risk. And my final comment before I hand over is that for NHI to be successful, and if we are to improve the access to healthcare, we're going to improve the quality of healthcare for all South Africans, then those building blocks need to be in place. And to ensure them in place, we are proposing a milestone-based approach to implementation. I know we're not the first company to suggest that. And to go into this in a little bit more detail, I'm now going to hand over to Amrita Ranagar to take you through our proposal. Thank you.
Did we lose you there?
Amrita, are you on mute?
Apologies. Good evening, and thank you to the honorable members of the Portfolio Committee of Health for the opportunity to engage you on this critical meeting. Healthcare is complex all over the world. We are dealing with the health and lives of our people. Life healthcare, as Anna mentioned, unequivocally supports the attainment of universal healthcare for all South Africans. However, there are many components that need to be in place in order to realize the objectives of NHI. but with most critically being the human resources for health. So our journey towards attaining universal health care began in 2007 when the ANC resolution was passed. Since then, the country has engaged in the commentary process for the green and white paper policy papers, the NHI draft bills, as well as the public hearings, of course. Sorry, honourable members, I just seem to be having some technical difficulties here. So our journey towards attaining universal healthcare coverage started in 2007 when the ANC resolution was passed. Since then, the country has engaged in the commentary process of both the NHI White and Green policy papers, draft NHI bills, as well as the public hearings. Honourable members, this extended timeline of the last 14 years in itself is indicative of the complexity of our healthcare reform journey. Of course, this is further complicated by the uncertainty that has been brought about by the pandemic. Critical point is that amongst this complexity, the recommendations made by the Competition Commission from the lengthy inquiry into the private healthcare sector must be considered for implementation. Much has been achieved in terms of understanding the complex nature of our health system, but we have so much more to do and have yet to put all our might and strength into improving the healthcare delivery system. Taking into account the enormity of this reform and the various components that need to be in place, a very lengthy implementation process is anticipated. Therefore, it is our view that a time-based approach will be challenging. The end game is crystal clear in terms of what we need to achieve. We need to approach this critical reform on a milestone-based approach, one step at a time. The bill proposes that both phase one and phase two be completed within a specified time period, with phase two completion being envisaged by 2026. However, there is a risk that the NHI will become fully operational prior to the positive and enabling outcomes being achieved. We therefore are not in support of a time-based approach. Honourable members, we should be dependent on the actual achievement of concrete milestones, which will enable an effective rollout of NHI. A monitoring and evaluation process is critical for the most rapid achievement of milestones. We do believe that guidance must be taken from the World Health Organization Health Systems Framework and the Presidential Health Compact, which identifies components that need to be in place, as well as where the existing health system needs to be improved or strengthened before we can move towards universal healthcare. The World Health Organization Health Systems Framework and the Presidential Health Compact sets out the interventions or activities that need to be realized in order to achieve universal healthcare. We believe that the implementation of the fund should be linked to the completion of the interventions set out in respect of each of these pillars that you see on the slide, and not the fixed dates that have been specified in the bill. As such, the bill should target the achievement of these established implementation milestones instead of the fixed dates. Honourable members, if we build a hospital and we put equipment and do not have any nurses or doctors to treat our patients, we will not be able to deliver healthcare. There is some interdependency amongst these pillars. We saw this quite clearly during the pandemic when either we had sufficient beds available for patients but were challenged by a shortage of nurses, or were challenged by a shortage of beds. As mentioned previously, the monitoring and evaluation is absolutely critical. There must be an independent approval or sign-off process that assesses whether these milestones have been met satisfactorily, so as to enable the effective rollout of NHI. the adequate supply of competent human resources is the most critical foundation. And this is evidenced based on what's indicated within the World Health Organization Health Systems Framework, as well as the Presidential Health Compact. A milestone approach allows for management of this sequentially. We will be able to bank successes in an incremental fashion and really gain traction in implementing NHI. Honorable Chair, I will now hand over to my colleague, Dr. Sharon Basudevan, Executive Head for Education at Lighthouse.
Thank you very much, Amrita. So I think human resources is going to be key to the NHI, because the NHI is about creating access to healthcare. And this cannot materialize without adequate healthcare professionals. When we speak to sufficient healthcare workers, we must emphasize the need for the development and training of healthcare workers to meet the current and the future healthcare needs of the country. Management skills for the management of facilities, these skills do not come easy, and we need a concerted effort to develop our managers and then hold them accountable for smooth operations. Management of facilities has been highlighted frequently and determines clinical outcomes. It is our experience that there is a direct correlation between the competence of a hospital manager and the performance of a hospital. A hospital manager makes or breaks a hospital based on its capability to run a hospital. In terms of infrastructure, we need sufficient facilities across the continuum of care over multiple geographies, both rural and urban. The Office of Health Standards Compliance sets the standards which must be applied to all facilities to raise the level and quality of care to enable our communities to benefit. Accreditation of facilities, both in the public and private sectors, is critical to improving the overall quality and standard of care. When it comes to capital, sufficient capital requires investment models that are fit for purpose. If it is not attractive, investment, then the investors, including the international donor agencies, may not support it. It would be detrimental to the entire health system, both public and private, if investors or donors decide not to direct their funding towards this critical investment. The reimbursement models should be simple, with attractive incentives for the patient, the purchaser, and the provider. Next slide, please, Amrita. So coming back to our health workers, sufficient healthcare workers, I mean, if you just think about that, we have a nurse-led healthcare model in South Africa. We already have a critical nursing shortage that we're all familiar with. A recent study supported by both the National Department of Health and the Hospital Association of South Africa cites that currently we have a shortage of anything between 26 to 62,000 nurses, and these numbers will get worse within the next few years. The contributing factors include an aging nursing population, introduction of the new nursing qualifications with limited numbers for training, reduced training outputs currently sitting around 3,000 nurses per annum, and a general lack of interest in the profession. The COVID pandemic demonstrated the critical shortage once again, both in the public and private sector. Short-term government contracts were offered in various provinces, and we in the private sector moved nurses between provinces to meet the needs of the patient. The lack of specialized nurses and the delay in training more of them, together with the challenges in transitioning from the legacy qualifications to the new ones further exacerbates the problem. NHI will see the acceleration of primary health care clinics, and we currently do not have sufficient nurses to support these structures. This is a burning platform that must be addressed sooner rather than later. While we all know there are more specialist doctors in the private sector than the public sector, we must agree that the overall number of doctors for our country are inadequate, and the slide adequately reflects the same when we compare ourselves with other countries. Let us not forget all the other healthcare professionals like pharmacists, physiotherapists, occupational therapists that must also be trained. In terms of management development, this is key to our future. The training of this specialized group will determine the success of NHI and the delivery of quality health care to the people of this country. Thank you, Honorable Chair. I will now hand over to my colleague, Andre Joseph, to take us to the next section.
Thank you very much, Sharon, and good evening, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members of the Committee. Having considered the information shared by colleagues, we will now propose certain areas that both the public and private sectors can collaborate and partner on. Next slide, please, Andrea. So Life Healthcare is of the opinion that we can collaborate with the state in the following four areas. And we will now unpack these four areas, starting with number one in red, the human resource education and training component. So to iterate what Sharon has explained to the committee, we definitely need more healthcare workers to address the delivery of the NHI. In addition to the supply of doctors and nurses, we should not overlook the training of other members of the multidisciplinary team, again, as Sharon has explained, and especially the hospital managers. We believe them to be a critical cog in the delivery of healthcare. It is thus essential that both sectors operate in an enabling environment to increase the training of healthcare workers to be able to deliver on the NHI. Please forward the return. Life Healthcare has a proud tradition of training nurses at our seven colleges across the four provinces for more than 25 years now. At the height of our training, as Adam alluded to, we delivered 1,500 nurses per year into the healthcare environment. This training was not only for our own requirements, but we also trained on behalf of government and for individual students wanting to join our colleges. Therefore, the entire nurse pool was increased. Unfortunately, in 2021, we were only able to train 237 nurses. We therefore propose that this college platform also be used to train doctors, both the specialists as well as the medical subspecialists. We want to bring to the attention of the committee that Life Healthcare has now, for many years, supported doctor training through the various colleges of medicine. We also provide direct financial support for the subspecialist training that is done at various medical schools. And in addition to this, Life Healthcare has been a proud supporter of the Public Health Enhancement Fund to the tune of $46 million. In terms of the skills transfer program, we want to suggest that an exchange program for staff between the public and private sectors will add value and enhance the career development of all categories of staff. There are lessons to be learned in both sectors, and we do believe that transferring staff between the sectors will just enhance their training. Next slide, please. So given the extent of our HR shortage, we suggest that an urgent intervention is required to address the policy impediments. And we will now, in the next slide, address these impediments. This slide details examples of impediments that we believe that if it's addressed quickly, will lead to almost immediate gains in the health system. The first box on the left-hand side speaks to the limited accreditation of private nursing colleges. We have in the past demonstrated Life Healthcare's ability to generate significant numbers of nurses each year and can easily do this again if allowed to. The next three boxes highlight the obstacles to increasing the number of doctors in our system. For example, there's potentially a role for private providers to play with respect to doctor education, particularly given the clinical expertise that resides in the private sector. Given the success with which nurses have been trained in South Africa's private health sector, we believe there is merit in investigating whether the private sector should at least be allowed to play a role in supporting the training of doctors. To illustrate this point, doctors from sub-Saharan Africa are employed in the USA and in Europe, but find it difficult to be employed in South Africa. So the restrictions on the employment of foreign doctors in South Africa, we believe, is a further impediment that, if removed, will increase the number of doctors available for our system. As mentioned in the findings of the HMI, the fact that the private sector cannot employ doctors has inhibited the evolution of innovative and integrated models of care. And this is something that we can address fairly quickly. Next slide, please. Thank you, Amrita. We've addressed the human resource education and training, and now we're just going to spend some time on the next three components indicated in red. That's the hospital management services, supply chain management, as well as capacity. Next slide, please, Amrita. If you will allow me, I just want to spend some time on the supply chain management, but I want to mention that the provision of hospital management services and the utilization of spare capacity is our offer to the public sector in ways that we can partner, and we want this to be explored even further. We want to spend some time unpacking possible collaboration in terms of the provision of imaging and radiology services. Both Pete and Adam spoke extensively around the expertise that Life Healthcare has in this field. Life Healthcare, via the Alliance Medical Group, is the largest provider of radiology to the governments of the UK, Ireland, and Italy, as mentioned earlier. The Alliance Medical Group operates in public hospitals, and some innovative methods in rural areas allow this radiology services to be available there. The dynamic relationship that the Alliance Medical Group has with these governments increases access to care services, and in so doing, speeds up the diagnosis of conditions and therefore the subsequent treatment of these conditions. Next slide, please, Amrita. I don't think this presentation would be complete if we didn't spend some time to look at the lessons learned from COVID and the vaccine rollout. We believe that the pandemic was an emergency and both sectors treated it with the necessary urgency that it deserved. We suggest that the provision of a UHC also requires our collective urgent attention. Our response to the pandemic and the vaccine rollout demonstrated the ability of the sectors to collaborate effectively across these various areas that's listed on the slide. Honorable members, I implore you that we would like you to take away only two messages from all these lessons learned during the COVID pandemic. And the first one is, even where hospital beds were available, not having enough doctors and nurses rendered those beds inoperable. And point number two, where the collaboration between the public and the private sectors were effective, we increased access to services and thereby improved the clinical outcomes. We therefore are confident that through these actions, we saved lives. Honourable members, I would now like to hand over to our Group CEO, Peter Wharton, to conclude our presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable members, and thank you to the Life Healthcare team for the contribution to this afternoon and now this evening's presentation. I'd like to just go back to what Andre mentioned and re-emphasize the lessons that we saw or have learned through COVID. One, it clearly demonstrated in stark terms the shortage of healthcare facilities and healthcare professionals. And for those that choose to argue that we do have enough nurses and do have enough doctors, we as Life Healthcare take a very firm stance that logic is flawed and unacceptable. the positive learning out of COVID was that working together between the public and private participants in the healthcare system, we improved delivery for the country, and no doubt that cooperation and partnership saved lives. It's in our assessment that when we come to our conclusions, that the constant conversation that the NHI is around funding and that the delivery of UHC and our support thereof is a matter of money is a flawed argument. I thought as a professional that left banking after 25 years and moved to healthcare that the conversations about money would dissipate and we'd concentrate on health matters. And I'm disappointed when I hear constant references in implementation of NHI focusing on funding as opposed to what we see as the real issues. We acknowledge that this is the single most difficult undertaking by government, but we again emphasize that government is not on its own to bring the resolution and delivery of the NHI to fruition. We would like to be part of it, and government should see us as a partner. I re-emphasize the point that Adam made, that the concentration and operational risk with a single payer system is too high. I come from an industry that is expert in managing operational risk and high volume systems, and I cannot contemplate how we would make something this complex work, and I don't think I know a group of executives anywhere in the world, not just South Africa, but anywhere in the world, that would be able to design, implement, and sustain such a highly complex system on a day-to-day basis. So it is our view that the risk is simply too high for this country to bear. I re-emphasize that it is our proven view that there are insufficient number of healthcare workers, nurses and doctors, in the present and in the future under current circumstances, necessary for the successful delivery of NHI. It does beg the question why we as Life Healthcare are not allowed to train our full complement of nurses at 1,500. And I would re-emphasize and urge that we accelerate allowing us to do so, as we believe it helps solve the problem in the future. To meet the demands of the NHI, we need adequate infrastructure and facilities. And our milestones-based approach emphasizes that in the correct order of prioritization. It goes without saying that excellent administration is essential. So we wrap that up, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, with a six-point conclusion where it makes it clear from our perspective as to exactly where the emphasis should lie. We urge and employ Honorable Members to take the message away that an implementation plan based on the achievement of concrete milestones, acknowledging that we need enough nurses and doctors, that we need enough infrastructure and facilities, and that we need enough excellent administration, is absolutely key to the success of the plan and for our country. And my closing comment is, Life Healthcare sees itself as a partner in achieving this significant delivery for our country. Thank you, Honorable Chairman and Honorable Members.
Thank you very much, Mr. Waterhood, and to your team for your presentations. We appreciate you coming here today to do these presentations to the Portfolio Committee. We have a number of members who would want to raise some points with you, and I'm going to mention their names. It's Honorables Harvard, Wilson, Zukacha, Gela, Clark, Siwela, in that order. Is there any other member whom I have missed who wants to raise anything with the presenters? You might just shout your name on the platform now. If not, we will start in that order, and I'm going to repeat it. It is Hubbard, Wilson, Sukacha, Gela, Clark, Siwela. Thank you very much. And if you could please, after that, just give us your responses to those questions. Thank you.
Honourable Chairman, I don't want to make like a disappearing act, but I will be moving into the room with my colleagues for the question and answer session. You will see me in a different location. I'm on my way.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, and also thank you, presenters. We appreciate your input. I have two questions. First one, on NHI administration, you are concerned the single-payer system creates enormous concentration and operational risk. What is your basis for this concern? Is it based on empirical evidence on similar systems? If so, please share with your research with us. Second question. We understand your concern that NHI implementation is time-based, thereby runs the risk of premature implementation. Are you aware on Section 57.1b of the bill, which states that national health insurance will be gradually phased in using progressive and programmatic approach based on financial resource availability? I thank you.
Thank you, and thank you very much for your presentation. Lots of food for thought in it. I principally want to deal with the what we would call a maldistribution of health professionals. And other people who've presented seem to think that this actually will be exacerbated by NHI and not improved on it. Now, it's little wonder that many health professionals, particularly highly qualified doctors, etc., are loath to work in the public health system, principally because the hospitals are under-resourced, they don't have sufficient equipment. In some theatres, we've had theatres in Mpumalanga closed down because there's no air conditioners working. And all of these kind of things create problems for health professionals, specialists and surgeons in particular, who are in a country where we are already sitting with billions of rands worth of medico-legal claims based on malpractice and hospital problems. It's little wonder that we have a maldistribution of health professionals. And I want to deal specifically with nurses because you are categorical in your statement that there are more than enough nurses. I find this fascinating from our perspective because we are so often having to fight to get graduated nurses positions. So the question is, you're saying there's insufficient. We are finding very often the opposite. And please, my picture may be skewed. I'm not in any way saying that you are incorrect. So one of the earlier presenters said there were three pillars that will hold up the NHI, what actually hold up the health system. The first of those being that it must be affordable and sustainable. The second one, that health facilities must be accessible. Health access to proper health must be accessible. And thirdly, obviously, the quality of health is critical. And those are the essential foundations, I think, for any health system. And yet we do not have that in place, certainly in the public health sector. There is essentially the quality of healthcare in very many provinces, particularly those that are particularly rural, are abysmal. Very few people in the rural areas have reasonable access to proper health facilities. And quite frankly, with the cut of budgets and particularly in human resourcing and in infrastructure, there most definitely is an indication that our current system is not affordable or sustainable at the moment. And I'm pleased to note that you are prepared to partner and that indeed you are prepared to assist, because I think this is going to be critical. And hospital managers were raised, and we have submitted lots of questions about lots of hospitals where hospital managers and senior personnel have actually been employed with not even 5 years experience in the medical industry, let alone having any administrative or financial background. So this is a concern. So my question is, with all of these things taken into account, and even with a partnership with organizations such as yourself, should we not be rather targeting the foundation and the three pillars of sustainability, affordability, accessibility, and quality, and getting that right before the NHI should even be considered? I thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me also welcome the presentation. Chair, I've got just one comment and two questions that I would like to ask from the team. During the presentation, Chair, the team has made an interesting recommendation that the NHI milestones needs to be aligned to the presidential health compact pillars and the WHO health systems framework. Your submission is noted, I must indicate. We should also like to encourage you to also communicate this to the Presidential Health Compact Committee through your stakeholder group. That is my first comment. My question now is on slide 13. You recommended that appropriate reimbursement models be considered for the NHI. Can you please specify which models would you consider to be appropriate vis-a-vis those that are not appropriate? I'm asking this question based on the findings by the Health Market Equity Panel on current provider payment mechanisms, specifically issues related to supply-induced demand and increase in utilization and expenditure of private health services not justified by changes in demographics, risk profile of the beneficiary of medical schemes. In your response, can you please also consider the proposed reimbursement mechanisms and the process of determining these rates by the level of care within the white paper and the NHIP? Then the last question, has Life Healthcare any thoughts on task shifting and task sharing to moderate the HRH challenges? Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me first welcome the presentation. I've got two questions that I want to ask. My first question, your presentation proposes a single fund and a multi-payer system for NHI. Can the presenter please expand on this point with a special focus on the benefits of this proposed funding model and how it will impact on reducing financial intermediaries that have been shown to increase non-healthcare cost. My second question, it is your assertion that NHI must not be implemented prior to the achievements of the milestones that you have outlined in your presentation. In your view, how long do you think the health system strengthening initiatives that you have outlined could take to achieve? And is NHI not meant to improve resourcing and funding of the health system to ensure that these milestones are reached? Please comment. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson. I also just have two questions to ask. One, shortages of healthcare workers are a major concern. Your presentation highlighted the impediments to addressing human resource challenges. What recommendations or changes to the NHI or to the above-mentioned policies can you make to ensure that the bill meet the human resources requirements? And then secondly, what implications will a shortage of healthcare workers have on the adequate service delivery within the sector? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. The opportunity. The first question is that you worked with NH implemented immediately after the devastating World War II, where the infrastructure was decimated by the war. Can you share with the committee how the NHS did this, and also share with us what is currently being done health equity in South Africa? The second question is, in these nine milestones that you have identified, what time frame would you suggest for each milestone? Can they be run in parallel? Do you think that by employing this method, we will ever implement a single health system for the country? And lastly, is Life Health Care asserting that because of the perceived risk that you state is so high, the status quo must be retained until the HR infrastructure and management challenges that you have outlined have been resolved? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, honorable members. I do not think there are any other members that want to ask any questions. So I'm just going to mention what I want to speak about. I want to speak about four areas. The one is your point you raised on SLAs, on tariffs, certificate of need, and on service providers. Now, your recommendation on the first one, that SLAs are best set at national level and operationalized at provincial level is noted. Are you aware that some of your competition in your market do not have a national footprint? And what do you suggest these providers ought to do, or should they be excluded from these SLAs? And also whether you would consider HMI recommendations on the barriers of entry into the facility market and what your view would be on that. On my point on the tariffs, your recommendations on key parameters to be considered when tariffs are determined is noted. Are you aware of Section 26, which talks about the pricing committee and the different stakeholders who will form part of the committee? Do you perhaps need further clarity on this section? And then the point that I want to raise on certificate of need, whether you'd be able to share with the committee your views about the HMI recommendation on the certificate of need. And this question in specific I am posing because this is one of the things that need to be addressed in the private hospital market. the concentration of private facilities within metropolitan areas, which does not follow the healthcare need, particularly from the rural provinces, is a point in question. And then I have one more question I want to raise with you, and that's the one on the service providers, that if you could please help me understand from your presentation whether you're insinuating that the NHI, under the NHI, only the state service providers will be contracted, and what actually informs this view, and where possibly in the bill did you find this view? Thank you very much. I think those are all of the questions from the committee members. You're very welcome, you and your entire team, Mr. Wharton Hood, to respond to these, and be looking forward to those responses. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, and to the honorable members for listening to our presentation and asking such valuable questions. There are some themes here, and I would ask the subject matter experts around the table to be able to address them. Regrettably, I missed the first honourable member's two questions while I was in transit between my presentation room and where I am now. Adam, is there anything that arose in the first two questions that you would like to cover before I coordinate the rest?
Yes, it was about the the two questions are on the single fund, single payer.
Right.
And why the operational risk is the basis for our view on the operational risk.
Sure.
And then are we aware of Section 57.1B, which talks about a programmatic approach to implementing NHI rather than a milestone? So we can talk about that under milestone.
Which is then under milestones, and perhaps I will address the notion of the operational risk and why we have such a firm stance on it. System that undertakes to be a national provider across such a complex landscape requires the creation of a technology process that cannot fail. In addition to which, the resource and support required to process this volume of transactions on a daily basis and at such small levels and values is not necessarily risk worthy and is probably going to be insurmountably expensive to make available 24/7. I've had comparisons drawn in my office between the national payment system and the single payer system that's been advocated, and I would argue that they are incomparable. Yes, the national payment system transmits billions, if not trillions, of rands worth of transactions, but they're done in very, very high value, and the nature of the transactions are generic, and their validation processes are relatively simple by comparison. In the context of what is being contemplated in the single payer system, both the volume, the complexity, and the variability, in addition to which the auditability and verification requirements per transaction, I cannot fathom how that system could be designed, and I shudder at the difficulty in managing such a complex system. In addition to which, if it were to fail, the whole healthcare system would grind to a halt. Whilst the provision of service, it doesn't impact on the ability of doctors and nurses to actually do their jobs, the cash flows that flow from it could bring the ultimate value transmission that supports the delivery of healthcare to a standstill. And in so doing, I feel that it would be appropriate that the country consider and adopt a multi-payer system so that if there were any difficulties encountered, such a disruption would not bring the provision of care to a standstill or be compromised. Having said that, a multi-payer system also allows us to insist that the providers of such services compete for business and that the volume of work afforded or awarded to individual participants is on a competitive bid basis with a view to driving the costs of administration down to the most efficient and representative cost per transaction. In a single payer system, such an opportunity does not exist because there is no alternative provider and there's no competitive mechanism by which to actually force efficiencies into the underlying administration. So whilst multi-payer single fund doesn't seem to provide or, shall we say, get the recognition and support it deserves, it comes with economic outcomes and competitive outcomes that will drive for a far more efficient system. And so it's a combination of risk, and it's also an opportunity to improve the financial outcomes underpinning it. And I see one of the honourable members mentioned the context of innovation. If one thinks about a multi-payer system, these respective providers will have to compete for work. They will be obliged to be able to bring their prices down, otherwise they won't receive work. So I'm a strong advocate for multi-payer single fund. I'm a strong advocate, we are a strong advocate for delivering that back to the country. And I trust that my answers find favour with honourable members and will be absorbed. In the context of moving on to the other issues that have been raised, Adam, do you want to deal with the milestone-based approach and answer those questions in composite?
Certainly, Pete. And Andre, you can come in if I miss certain points. So first question is, we do understand that the bill talks about a programmatic approach to implementing NHI, and we understand that. What we'd like that to be is a little bit more explicit in terms of what that has to deal with. And certainly that the Presidential Compact and the World Health Organization, they're fairly clear in terms of what those building blocks need to be in place. And what we would hope that in terms of going forward, that we are fairly clear in terms of what those building blocks are and what we need to achieve per building block. What we're not saying is that NHI is something you just turn on and off. We know there's a journey we're going to go down here. And we're certainly not saying we stop everything until we get this in place, because we know it's we're going through a journey. Certainly not saying is you have to do building block one, then you move on to building block two, et cetera. There are a whole range of initiatives which we should be starting all of them now with different work streams. You know, with resources, with doctors, you know, if you want to train specialists, it takes you at least 10 years. And every year that goes past, if we don't increase the number of specialists, it just delays the issue by another year. You know, there has to be a real focus primarily in terms of how we increase the level of healthcare workers in this country. But that doesn't mean we wait until we get the perfect number of healthcare workers in the country before we implement NHI. It is a journey. But what we are saying is that if you don't have sufficient healthcare workers, you don't have sufficient hospital management and competent management, you don't have sufficient accredited facilities and sufficient access, then we're not going to achieve the objectives of NHI. And for this, this is not about ticking boxes and saying we now have a national health insurance system. This is all about improving the access and quality of healthcare for all South Africans. I think that covers it. If I missed anything out on
that. No, I'm happy.
Sharon, would you mind just clarifying our position on the number of nurses in the country? I think there was a slight misunderstanding as to how we wanted to, what the problem statement was, our position, and how we would close that gap down.
Thank you very much, Pete. I think we just want to confirm that in our presentation, we did speak about the shortage of nurses rather than us having a sufficient number. And we did confirm the maldistribution of health professionals, you know, between the public and the private sector. You know, currently we have registered in South Africa about 285,000 nurses. And, you know, we don't know, you know, whether all of them are actually employed in the country, but we depend on the database system run by the regulator that is not able to specify exactly whether these people are employed or not. And so that makes it very difficult. But in the study that I cited, I also said that 85% of nurses currently are employed in the public sector and 15% in the private sector. And so, you know, we've got you know, statistics to kind of support some of the numbers and how the distribution works. But while we say that, we know we have a shortage, you know, and we don't have adequate healthcare workers in this country. And, you know, one of the points was, well, will this have implications for the service delivery? Well, I want to say that I think it's already having implications for service delivery, and that was proven during the pandemic. And we saw the sudden rush to offer contracts, to bring people on board, and to really start to share our resources. So I think that is a point that we want to confirm. Around the concept of task shifting and task sharing, it's something that we continually explore, you know, bringing in other cadres of workers. We were one of the first groups to start exploring the use of healthcare technicians. And we know, once again, a lot of the implementation around some of these concepts and introducing new levels of workers is you know, not encouraged because we don't have enabling regulation. And so we are really firm believers that if we have enabling regulation around the training of healthcare workers and introducing new cadres of healthcare workers to support the healthcare system, we will definitely make much more progress. Thank you, Pete.
Chen, thank you so much. While I ask the team to contemplate their response to the alternative reimbursement mechanisms, please, I'd just like to make a comment on the Honourable Member's question around the maldistribution of healthcare professionals in the system as it presents itself currently, and perhaps a comment on where doctors choose to work. The Honourable Members are well aware that doctors that choose to work in life healthcare facilities are not employed by life healthcare, and they choose to practice in our facilities by choice, as opposed to us having any other lever to bring them there. They practice in our facilities because we provide excellent infrastructure, nursing support, facilities and theatres, together combined with rehabilitation and a continuum of care that allows them to discharge their responsibilities to deliver quality care in an environment in which they feel safe. I've stated the obvious, but I wanted to draw the conclusion that the ultimate management of these facilities is what creates it in a sustainable fashion. I have an observation, only having 18 months experience in the healthcare industry, that a hospital manager's job is one of the most complex jobs that I have seen. It brings together a multitude of disciplines and a very, very pressurized environment, dealing with very well-educated professionals, solving problems from scheduling all the way through to electricity, power challenges, and hygiene issues, and staff shortages, and so on. So I would advocate that in uplifting up all our facilities, it's not about just spending money on the infrastructure. It's making sure that we actually have in place capable managers who are able to look after these very important assets. And that the combination of infrastructure improvement together with the necessary executive oversight and management of these facilities go hand in hand. Great facilities with no management will be a waste of money and they will fail. And great management with inadequate infrastructure will not allow us to be able to deliver the quality of the care that we are promising to our country. An alternative, may we then move on to alternative reimbursement models? Thank you, Ridwan.
Thanks, Pete. Thanks, all members. I think just to clarify our point around appropriate reimbursement models, we are completely aligned with the recommendations that came out of the NHI bill as well as the findings on the HMI. So I think we acknowledge the fragmentation in the private sector. We know that it's predominantly driven by fee-for-service with scant primary care, and that really drives utilization in the environment. And I think the principles we aligned with is one that all reimbursement models must be aligned to population or episodic outputs, that align clinical multidisciplinary teams and really pay on a risk-adjusted basis for outcomes. And I think for us, those principles are sound and we support those, and we think that those are the basis for effectively contracting the private sector to deliver through the NHI.
Thank you very much, everyone. Another point to make a comment on is One of the honourable members asked about improving the affordability of healthcare services in South Africa and our view around how we could help improve affordability. And it's our considered opinion that affordability will improve if we eliminate waste, not through the reduction in the quality of care. So our hypothesis and how we feel that we are able to participate is by maintaining the quality of care that Life Healthcare stands behind and is proud to deliver, but improving affordability must come from the elimination of waste that is within the system, and it's our job to make sure that we continue to eliminate it. In the context of the milestones approach and how long we think it would then take to implement, the Honourable Member has asked a very, very difficult question. In the context of understanding how long those milestones will take to execute is obviously a determinant of the overall time it will take to deliver the project. We just feel that by focusing on milestones, there will be a logical and coordinated approach focusing on the most important issues first so that we can build the outcome. Like building a hospital or building a classroom, you have to get the foundations right. We can't start with the roof. But the Honourable Member did ask, could we do some of these things in parallel? And the answer to that is a definite yes. So in the context of the project management, if we focus on milestones, we'll be focusing on the resources and the effort required to make sure that we put the deliverables in place. A focus on a time-based outcome may produce unrealistic pressure, and once the time-based outcomes are put in place and they are exceeded, it's very difficult to then actually draw accountability back as to where it failed. So we feel a milestones-based approach is far more in line with the way that we manage very large projects inside our own company, and it's a methodology that we feel with which we feel comfortable. Honourable Chair, in the context of recounting the history of the successful delivery in the United Kingdom and the NHS's efforts post-World War II, I feel inadequately qualified to be able to give a detailed account of the step-by-step process that put them in such a formidable position today. I would ask some leniency that we perhaps answer that question in writing, unless anyone of my team has a better recollection of the history and all the steps than I do.
You're not that old.
Adam, are you younger than you look?
You don't know, Fred.
But thank you. We will come back in and answer that question to the Honourable Members in writing. Adam,
yes,
please, have I left?
What has just happened to you? Can you hear me? Mr. Waterwood, can you hear me? Honourable members, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, Chair.
Yes, Chair, we can hear you.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Honourable Chairperson. We seem to have some technical difficulties with our boardroom connection. We will, however, continue with responding to your questions using the platform.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. And apologies, we lost visuals unless you feel that... Adam, do you want to come in?
Yes, Chair. Sorry, Honourable Chair, there was just, you asked some questions. And the one is about, certainly we see the contracting taking place with both the public and private perspective. No way do we see that private be excluded. The question you did have about the HMI and the concentration of assets in cities and not in sort of more the rural areas, and that is correct. I mean, the assets, hospital assets in particular, are, you know, concentrated in the cities. You know, just from a life healthcare perspective, you know, we do have, we've got hospitals in some smaller towns, in Frederiksberg on the Western Coast, and Queenstown in the Eastern Cape, Empangeni and KZN, my KZN colleagues might look at me a little differently. They think Empangeni is a small town. And I do want to say that you're managing these facilities in the smaller towns is really difficult. It's difficult to get doctors.
It's difficult to get nursing staff. It's difficult to get competent management. And, you know, like during COVID, one of these small towns, one of the hospitals, they lost their entire management team. They're all but COVID at the same time. And the question is, how do you manage a facility when your management aren't in the hospital? And so the hospitals in the smaller towns do come with challenges. Not that they would want to be there, but it's a lot more difficult to operate. And just an example, we had a hospital in a small town in KZN, and we could never get that hospital to work. It was always unsustainable in terms of enough doctors to work there, enough patients, et cetera. So it does come with challenges. But there was a question regarding the SLAs in our view that at a national level in terms of contract, but operation at a local level, you talked about, and you raised a question about, so what does it mean if you don't have a national presence? Our view is that it shouldn't really impact. You can have a general contract at a national level, which plays out across the provinces. And the provinces then contract with facilities that are in those provinces on the terms negotiated at a national level. Are you agreement with that? Yes. But did I miss anything out from the chair? What was the last question regarding statistical disease? Was our
several views on that? Because of the fact that we've got concentrations in terms of supply and
Well, I think in terms of statistical need, there's a, I suppose the deal is trying to deal with the redistribution of resources across the country to areas of need. It's quite a difficult process to go through. We think there are a number of challenges to statistical need. We do believe that you want to increase the resources around the country if you want to improve access. But our view is it comes back to the our proposition is that if you don't have sufficient nurses and doctors, you know, you really, the civil need won't fix the issue. We need to train more nurses, we need to train more doctors, we need to ensure that they are encouraged and incentivized to get into areas where there's no access to improve that access. That is our view. You know, we keep going on about the healthcare resources, but fundamentally, yeah, we could be sitting here in 10 years' time. And if we haven't trained more nurses, we haven't trained more doctors, we certainly won't be improving the level of access or level of quality of healthcare for all South Africans, irrespective whether the NHI fund is up and running, whether their reimbursement model is up and running, et cetera. If we don't have the resources, we're not going to improve access.
But Adam, I think that goes to the fundamental point, that improving accessibility and affordability of healthcare for South Africans, more South Africans are going to make use of the facilities that the country provides.
Yeah.
Which means the amount of work goes up, which means that we need more nurses and doctors to be able to meet that demand. And in so doing, just re-slicing the existing pie is not going to solve the problem. We have to create more nurses, more doctors.
Yes, thank you. And just from, you know, from our side is that there is a real firm commitment from Life Healthcare to assist in the training of healthcare professionals. More trained nurses, and we talk about nurses and doctors, but actually we shouldn't be the other healthcare workers, pharmacists, physios, etc. You know, and we are committed to working with government to increase the numbers we have in this country. Are the honourable chairs that have we sufficiently addressed the questions that were asked? And if we haven't, we can, you know, we will certainly regarding the NHS in 1948 and Minister Bevan, who introduced the NHS, we will certainly go back and have a look, and then. We can respond in that regard.
Thank you very much, all of you for responses. I'm going to just see that echo continues. Now it seems to be away. There is one follow-up question from Honorable Shiliki Munyai. He wants to raise something, so I'm going to allow him, and if he may please respond to whatever he raises. Honorable Munyai.
Honourable Chair, I won't be long. It seems, you know, is it Life Healthcare asserting that because of the perceived risk, your state, it is so high, the status quo of two-tier system must remain and be retained until the HR infrastructure management challenges and also training of the staff, hospital staff that you have outlined have been resolved. That's, and the other one, Honorable Chair, I don't think we're at one. Do you understand that the reimbursement under NHI is not going to be based on individual transmission at the PHC, since it is based on the prospective capitation and at the hospital level, it will be based on the DRGs. Lastly, I just want them really to help me, Honorable Chair. I've been asking this question over and over. You know, Honorable Chair, you know, look, I want to ask the simple question. When I was involved in a car accident with my brother, right? And the ambulance came and wanted to pick me up, who was less injured, and my brother was critically injured. Do they want to really, I'm saying, to me, I saw that as a discrimination based on socioeconomic status. Do they still want the status quo to remain? Despite that 8% of the GDP, you know, accounting to over 400 billion, serve the 16% of the population, and the rest are not in that degree. Do they still want the status quo that nothing should happen to rearrange or to change policy reform? Thank you, Honorable Chair, for the opportunity.
Sorry, Honourable Chair, may I just clarify with the Honourable Member, at this particular juncture in our country, the total healthcare spend is 500 billion, of which 250 billion is in the private sector and 250 billion is in the public sector. 400 billion does not go to the private sector. In the context of socioeconomic status, Life Healthcare will accept any patient into its facilities, irrespective of its socioeconomic status. We proved that and continue to support that as evidenced in everything we did during the course of COVID and any emergency cases that are presented in our ER facilities around the country. In the context of how we move forward to participate in providing care to the nation of South Africa, it's important for us to see our role as healthcare providers and help to improve the accessibility and affordability of healthcare services. As professionals, we are here to make a contribution together with government to take healthcare services to more people in South Africa. And we look forward to playing that role. Adam, do you want to add too?
Yes, sister. We do understand the reimbursement models that are proposed within the bill, and certainly we don't agree with a fee-for-service model. In fact, most of our reimbursement does not take place in the fee-for-service model currently. And we heard Discovery talking yesterday about moving to value-based care, and we're one of the organizations they're talking to in that regard. So we do have a clear understanding of that. We also understand the bill talks about DRGs, and I'd like to state that, you know, as a country, we don't have a national DRG grouper. We are reliant on an underlying procedure coding system and a diagnosis ICD system, which are not ours. And so there is a really long way to go if we want to have a national DRG-based reimbursement model for all hospitals in the country. This is not simple. So we do understand that, and we're very willing to participate in the development of that reimbursement models. Just the question about risk, you know, our point is not that, you know, we just sit with the current system and do nothing until everything's in place. What we are saying, though, that there is a journey we have to embark on. And that's the first thing. And we do have to make changes. But the second thing is, our point is that we will not achieve the objectives of NHI. We will not improve access and the quality of healthcare unless those building blocks are in place. So it's a journey we're going on. We're not saying we do nothing until everything's in place. But we have to be smart and understand that as you build these blocks, it will take us some time, and we got to change the system in the process. But ultimately, it's all about, you know, are we going to achieve the objectives of NHI? And for that to happen, these building blocks do have to be in place. Thank you.
Thank you very much to all of you for coming today. and I'm talking to Life Healthcare at the moment, for your presentation, for your responses, for the open and frank discussions which we could have had. Also to the honorable members that we could have had these discussions. We have really appreciated this opportunity. Ms. Majalamba, I just need to make certain before I let you go. Ms. Majalamba, I just need to make certain about our starting time tomorrow morning.
Good afternoon. We don't have hearings tomorrow morning. We only have hearings on
Friday. I mean on Friday, yes, on the 28th.
Starting at 10:15.
10:15. Thank you very much. So once again, maybe you want to give a final closing remark, Mr. Wharton Wood. You're very welcome, just before I close this meeting.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, and thank you to the Honourable Members for the constructive engagement. We welcome this opportunity, and we're thankful for this opportunity to express the research views of the company. And to re-emphasise, we do see ourselves as supporting the initiative. We'd like to be able to help and participate, and we'd like to be able to replicate a partnership model along the lines of which we've proven internationally, and to be seen as a responsible and reliable partner with government in this very important initiative for our country. Thank you to all the honourable members for their time, and to my team for the work that went into delivering this to you today.
Thank you very much. That brings us to a close, honourable members. I am going to adjourn this meeting. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Recording stopped.
The recording has stopped.